Policy on this beautiful March 15th. We'll come to order, please. Members, this is our last day to hear bills, and next Tuesday we'll hear the walkthrough of the omnibus, and then next Thursday mark up the omnibus, which means you bring your amendments, and we'll send the bill to finance. So we have lots to look forward to as we wind down. And then wind up as we go into the negotiating mode. Members, today in the audience, we have elementary principals visiting from across the state. And because we don't have quorum yet, I'm going to take some time to have those principals stand and call out your name, and like you did when you introduced yourselves to me, and the school from which you've come. So let's start here down at my far left.
I'm Kip Link. I'm a K-4 principal at Oak Ridge Elementary in the Sartell District.
Morning, I'm Rob Carlson. That's what Oxbow Creek Elementary in the Anoka Hennepin School District.
Paul Anderson, principal at Sand Creek Elementary in the Anoka Hennepin School District.
John Brown, principal at Washington Learning Center of New Orleans.
Rita Evans Becker, principal at Meadowbrook Elementary in the Hopkins School District.
I'm Greg Zender. I'm the elementary principal at Lakewood Police School in Litchfield.
Mary Tillison, principal at a K-3 building, Lake Harriet Lower in Minneapolis.
Stephanie Norsworth, principal at Pine City Elementary, Pine City.
Aaron Shelby, principal at Lakewood and Duluth, and also federal programs coordinator for Duluth Public Schools.
I'm John Miller, the executive director of the Minnesota Elementary Principal Association.
And I think we have principals picking up materials, but introduce yourself. Yes.
I'm Karen Kepler, principal at Meadow Ridge Elementary and the Life and Education Center.
And yes, please.
Did I?
The Kyra principal from Pasadena School District.
Any other principals? Yes, please.
Principal at Indian Mounds Elementary School in Indian.
And as I told them earlier, excuse me, sir, go ahead.
Patrick Smith, principal at Bassford Elementary, Maple Grove, Osceola School District.
Now, have I missed anyone? As I was telling them earlier, you know, schools, and these are elementary principals, can't be without school leaders. They are the people in charge of our education every day, and they are the school leaders for teachers, and they're also the school leaders for setting the atmosphere, the environment, the attitude for our students. So they are really important, and I always had great respect for my principals and looked to them as my instructional leader, even though I was in an earlier day of teaching, which I don't think has changed much, except for maybe the students in our classrooms have joined us from other ethnicities more than when I was in my active years of teaching, and that is so great that we can address the needs of all students. I'll call this meeting officially to order because there's a quorum. Members, today we're, as I said at the outset, hearing the last of our bills, and we begin today with House File 2750, a bill about modifying exemptions from compulsory school attendance. Welcome to the testifying table. Representative Barr, would you move your bill, please, so that we can hear it?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I would like to move House File 2750 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill.
Representative Barr moves 2750 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Welcome, and please say your name for the record and begin to explain this, and then your testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cal Barr, and this bill allows for the 3 days when a high school student is being recruited into the armed forces. This mandates that the 3 days, up to 3 days, that could be used for ASVAB testing, physical testing, and the day of actual swearing into the military, be excused absence. from any high school activities. And there's one other minor change that the revisor's office suggested in here, separating a mental health piece out of, or another exemption out of here. They just rearranged a couple of little pieces here. But the majority of the bill is the military, the exemption for the military, or the student to join the military. And as a testifier today, I have Sergeant First Class David Lowell of the Roseville Recruiting Station to explain the particulars.
Welcome, Sergeant Lowell. We're so glad to have you, and Sergeant Decker is also in the audience, and they're both recruiters at the Roseville office. So welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Sergeant First Class David Lowell.
And would you please proceed to give testimony as to why 2750 is a good bill?
Absolutely. In Minnesota, you have a very unique combination of things that produces very intelligent young men and women, and for us, having access to schools and being able to reach out to these students to allow them the opportunities to process for enlistment is sometimes challenging. So the ability for us as recruiters to go to schools and have them come with us out of the school, miss a day of school, to be able to join is critical. So for us, if we have a young man or woman who's trying to join, they are under 18, they're allowed to join when they're 17 years old with parental consent. So for our purposes, before we can do any type of work with them to be able to do medical examinations and do the enlistment process, the parents have to sign off, both mother and father, that it's okay for them to work with us. It's a federal form. It's a Department of Defense form, and it has very clear details in there stating that they're authorizing their son or daughter to be transported unsupervised by a recruiter to medical facilities at MAPS to get physicals done, to go take their ASVAB testing, and for the enlistment process. A lot of schools don't recognize that form as an authorization for us to be able to take students out of class. And that hurdle of having to additionally contact parents when they're at work, dealing with frustrations between faculty and various policies that they have that don't recognize that parental authorization, can oftentimes cause delays in processing. We've had instances where a gentleman was eligible for a particular program that we were offering, but the program was open at a first-come, first-served basis. So when we got the announcement, hey, this position's open today, first person to get an applicant on the floor is going to get it, and I'm calling mom and dad, nobody's answering the phone to get a letter to get the kid out of school when I already have an authorization from the parent that the school doesn't recognize. And I think having that flexibility and recognition of the time it requires to join, I think, is hugely important. I think it's a big improvement to the current system we're using.
Thank you, Sergeant Lowell. Questions for the testifier? Sergeant Lowell, would you talk a little bit about the recruiting in Minnesota and the struggle?
Absolutely. One of the key goals for the Army recruiters in the United States is to find highly qualified young men and women. The days of, if you can't make it doing something else, there's always the Army. What I heard when I was a kid, what my dad heard when he was a kid, that's long gone. We have a requirement to find highly intelligent young men and women. And Minnesota has a very unique combination of environmental factors, educational factors, employment factors that we have in the state the highest percentage of, we call alpha, which is the higher ranking scores on the ASVAB test, above 50. Out of Minnesota, it's above 60%, which is the highest in the nation. Mm-hmm. So it's fantastic. But at the same time, with as many opportunities as there are in the civilians, a lot of young students coming out of high school have the idea that going to college will automatically get them a good paying job. And unfortunately, that's not always true. I did some research the other day, and according to the Department of Education, 2015, on average in the United States, 19% of college freshmen will be able to complete their four-year degree in a four-year period of time. And with the current education system in high school, most people are getting tracked for college, college prep. There's very little focus on career development, you know, skills like that, which is where the Army really has a strong foothold. Being able to allow students to pick a job that they want to do, be trained in it, and be certified, so when they're done with their enlistment, they're able to actually be employed without the burden of student debt and with that confidence and maturity that comes with military service.
Thank you, Sergeant Lowell. You're right, confidence and maturity that come.
Absolutely.
Because our young men and women coming out of high school, you know, they need some time, and I think the military can provide that if they choose that. So thank you very much. Members, still no questions? Very good. Representative Kunesh-Badin, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for this. I have a question. What time of year of the school year do these these meetings take place that you would ask a student to leave school for?
Sergeant Lowell.
Absolutely. The answer is every day. Students are allowed to start processing for the Army 30 days prior to their 17th birthday. As far as being able to enlist, it's as soon as they turn 17 with parental consent.
Mm-hmm.
So some students are turning 17 their junior year. Some are not turning 17 until their senior year. But generally speaking, a senior can join usually April, give or take, of their junior year. They're considered a senior. And then juniors are allowed to join the reserve at the beginning of the junior year, and they're allowed to join active duty a few weeks after they finish their junior year. So predominantly the senior year is going to be a very busy time in that previous summer, but there is still some activity with juniors.
Representative Kudipudin.
Thank you. The reason I ask that question is that a junior and senior year, there are a lot of course, academic testing and expectations for completion of their classwork that needs to be done. And I'm wondering if there should be something in this bill that states if it is during like the MCA testing or an expected testing session or anything like that, that a student wouldn't be removed at that time and maybe work around the whole examination and project sort of homework expectation schedule.
Representative Barr, would you like to address that?
Yeah, I guess I can give it a whirl here. The ASVAB testing and the physicals and the rest of the three-day processing, the military has some ability to be flexible around that. But on the other hand, if the as far as the MCAs go, if the student is there's an opt-out clause in that, you can opt out of the mandated testing. The other pieces. The school assignments and whatnot, they still have to complete all of their school assignments. They still have to graduate. The military is not going to take somebody that has not graduated from high school. GED is probably pretty tough to get into the military these days. It used to be when I was in 1980, you could get in with a GED. It's almost impossible today. The military, you can actually complete a four-year degree in 2 years in the military with job training and some of the rest of it and finish your credits. So for some students, this is the right choice. For others that are, you know they need to go to college for their chosen career path, then they would not be taking this. This is be a one-on-one student basis, and there is flexibility around certain days. But as Sergeant Lowell mentioned, if there's a particular program that a student is looking for and there's only one day available, first come, first served, they would need to grab that. And some of these programs are extremely difficult to get into, but they're extremely rewarding. I have a nephew that is he actually runs he's in charge of the nuclear power plant on submarines. So a nuclear engineer, if you can get the opportunity to get into that, I think that would probably trump going to the MCAs that day. for that particular student.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you for considering that, and thank you, Chair. Well, when we're looking at different expectations for schools, and we are scoring schools on student achievement, this would certainly make a difference, could make or break a school if there are one or two or more students that are high achieving, and that score would make a difference in the grading or the scoring for that particular school. As a teacher myself and a test coordinator for a number of years, just trying to get kids back into the school to test and make up these tests that are mandatory by the state, it can sometimes really make a big difference in the student schedule as well as the teacher and the testing coordinating. So I would probably suggest that there's something in your bill that says during these standardized testing periods, students would not be exempt unless they have made some kind of previous plans with their school and with the state as far as testing goes. Thank you.
Representative Barr.
We can talk about that after we're done here. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that would be a good idea. But I do trust that school leaders and teachers also can provide for advice when it comes to our students wanting to get this exemption. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to understand the bill a little bit better, too.
Go ahead.
And so my question is on the new language, and it's beginning on line 2.4. It talks about the child's parent or guardian is in an active duty in a branch of the armed forces. So I'm trying to understand what we're providing for by adding this language.
Representative Barr, will you address lines 2.4 and 2.5 and the reason that's included? Because that's new language.
Madam Chair, this is one of the suggestions from the revisor's office. They moved that language out of Section 1. It says on line 1.21, active duty in the military service, that's part of that was already in statute, and they moved that back into a separate section, number 2. Okay. The language is slightly changed there, but they separated that from Section 1 and moved it into its own section.
Thank you, Representative Barr.
Okay.
So that it flows better and it's separated then. Instead of being among the list under number 1, it is now separated out, and that's a good way to organize.
Yes, Madam Chair. Section 1 was all about health contingencies.
Yes. Okay. Representative Barr, prior follow-up?
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Other questions from members? Seeing none, Sergeant Deck, right?
Decker,
it is. Yeah, I thought I said it correctly the first time in the night. Would you just come forward and introduce yourself? Matthias, are you nearby to offer another chair? Oh, I'm sorry. We have, is it Hannah? He's fine.
Good morning. I'm Sergeant Decker. I work out of the Roseville recruiting station. I'm the station commander. I work with Sergeant Lowell.
Sergeant Decker, to what extent do we have issues with our young men or women getting in to take care of these necessities if they want to pursue going into the armed forces?
Madam Chair, it's the constant rigmarole for these students. There are frustrations for both us, the students, the families, the faculty. It could be summed up in 3 days. That first initial day, if we're talking about the bill, would be an appointment, a meeting of qualifications, taking some tests, aptitude checks is big, and then fingerprints, just upfront processing to make sure they're going to be fully qualified. After that, the school counselors, they provide us a letter stating that they are on track to graduate. So we're only going to work with those that will graduate, because if they fall short of, let's say, a 2.0, that might be the standard this year. If they have below 2.0, they could possibly get kicked out and lose their opportunities, their benefits, bonuses, whatever they acquired through joining with us. So there are a lot of hurdles just to keep the ball moving to the benefit of the young adult. So it's just if we could sync better with the school, again, in 3 days. That first day, excuse them for initial processing, and then the next 2 days, it would be a job complete.
So Sergeant Decker is usually 3 consecutive days?
It wouldn't be consecutive. It could be in a perfect world, and we recognize it's not a perfect world. But it takes about, on average, 3 days to put somebody into the Army if it was all lined up. At the most, it would be 10 days, but within those 3 days, about 7 of those is going to be processing on our half and the MEPS, the processing station, and down at Fort Snelling.
So, Sergeant Decker, if a young man or woman comes to you and they've not taken the ASVAB, do you then encourage them to take the ASVAB, or is there other testing that will suffice?
Oh, absolutely. It's either the SASVAB within the school if they offer it, or with us it would be the ASVAB, where we would schedule them to go down to the MEPS, the Enlistment Processing Station at Fort Snelling. If they can't make it, we can afford them an opportunity to take the test in our office. And again, that's a 3-hour process in itself. But again, schedules, conflicts, just getting to that point.
Sergeant Lowell, anything to add to this discussion?
Basically, from what Sergeant Decker was saying, the process of enlisting, it is generally 3 days of actually doing processing, but that can be spread out over a couple weeks sometimes, depending on, you know, if people are missing documentation or there's issues getting family records and whatnot. Overall, having some sort of record, some sort of legal power behind us to be able to mm-hmm. give us mm-hmm. the opportunity to get with these students is hugely beneficial, because most of the time at this point we're relying on the schools wanting to work with us.
Sure.
So if we have situations where I've had guidance counselors who've called students out of class who've recently enlisted, and they're excited about joining the military, and they've got a $40,000 bonus to go to college, and they pick biomedical equipment repair, and they're fixing ultrasounds and X-rays, and they're excited, and they're going to join the reserve, and guidance counselor pulls them out and wants to talk to them about why they joined, and telling them that military is a bad idea, and college is going to be a better option, and to get out of their contract and whatnot. So, and then I've had other schools that are hugely supportive of us and allow us to do a lot of things that really benefit the students. So it's having some sort of official support is going to make a big difference to a lot of people.
Thank you, Sergeant Lowell. Representative Barr, do you want to give some closing comments, please? Oh, excuse me. Representative Haley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to offer support for Representative Barr and the bill, and just a comment on we want all kids to have a path after high school. And we, as you mentioned, we need kids to have training, and the military provides very good training. In relation to kids missing school, I'm just kind of shocked that there's such an issue with this. For example, we just had high school hockey tournaments. Oh, my gosh, my daughter missed like 5 days for hockey. So to miss some days of school to be making future plans on training and career options is a good thing, and I know kids miss many days to tour colleges as well. So I'm in support of your bill.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Closing comments, Representative Barr.
Madam Chair, I guess the closing comments, everything's really been said. For a favorable action on that bill, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barr. With that, the chair lays over 2750 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for taking time to come today, and best wishes. You are so important to us. Representative Erdahl. Welcome, Representative Erdahl, to the testifying table. If you'd like to move your House File 3589, a bill requiring reporting on civics test questions. Will you move your bill, please, Representative Erdahl, after you introduce yourself?
Representative Dean Erdahl, and do you want to do the amendment right away?
Sure. The chair will move the A1 amendment. Members, in your packets, you have the A1 amendment, and that's to line 21 after the WHO. We are adding graduated in the previous school year and. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Erdahl, please present 3589 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What the amendment just did is that we're trying to measure proficiency on this civics test, and this ensures that there really is only one point of uniformity when we can make a measurement, and that's after they graduate, because the way it's set up in the bill in 2016 is that you can take this test anytime from 7th through 12th grade. And so once they've got through, we can measure. And the purpose of this is that, we give these standardized tests, which the civics test is not in essence a standardized test, but it is a test required to be given in our schools. And the proficiency levels and everything in math and science and reading, they're all measured and reported. And it's not done that way in civics. And I'm not looking for individualized scores of students. It simply is, all we're asking for is that the aggregate be reported after graduation. So a school district, and the way I envision it, the teachers who administer this test would say that 70%, 100 took it, 70% passed it, pass it out, information on to the administration, who would then pass it on to the Department of Education. So what we're doing is trying to give more meaning to the test. Basically, in school performance reports, we pay attention to what we measure, and we don't measure civics. So it's important to raise the level for a lot of reasons that I've given before, and I'm sure I will in the future. If you want a long dissertation, I can give it to you, but I think that this is a pretty straightforward bill. All we're asking for is an aggregate score from the schools, just so we can see what's happening.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I will officially move 3589. It's already been amended, but I want it on record that we do have the bill in front of us officially. So, Representative Erdahl, do most schools give the civics test the senior year? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, really, we're just getting the first year of doing this. And I'm sure at this point, and I think Ms. Bloom here, who's prepared to testify as well, can attest when it's been given. But I'm guessing, or I'm pretty sure, that it's all over the map in terms of when it's being taken now.
Well, I ask that, Representative Erdahl, because if a teacher were to take note of the score, that would give impetus for perhaps concentrating more on the substance of civics, which, as you know, is begun in kindergarten and continues to grade 12 in our social studies standards. So, sometimes civics, I think, gets lost, but considering the fact it is part of the standards for social studies and that some may give the test earlier than the senior year, it would be good to pay attention so that we can ensure that our students understand our great republic. Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Jennifer Bloom, and I am the director of the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation is an organization that services teachers and students. We have student programs, Project Citizen, We the People. We train teachers. We write curriculum. We have a website that offers lessons that are tried and true, that have been vetted for teachers and hundreds of teachers. I think last year we had 3,000 users from Minnesota, and they access on average about 3 lessons apiece. If you think about that, and the time, they probably teach 100 students, it's a lot of impact with the website that actually is funded by the legislature. I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill. My organization was asked by Representative Erdahl if we could create the civics test every year, and now we're directed to do that. And that means selecting 50 of the 100 questions in the naturalization test administered by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Working with teachers, we consult with, I think the first year was about 40 teachers. We select the questions. We review all the test questions, and we pick the ones that are aligned with the Minnesota Social Studies standards in citizenship and government. By picking the ones that align best, it means that the students are required to master the content under the social studies standards, and that content is included in the civics test. It is already being taught. So the civics test itself is not a huge burden, and many teachers have told me that they already do it. They may not do it all. Some of them have said, we do it all every year. The requirement that they give them, you know, they grade them, they usually do. It's part of a test that they give. So that's not a big burden. If someone's not teaching the content required by the social studies standards, then it might be more of a burden. But how well do we know we're doing? And I think that's the essence of this bill. There's no national test that's helpful. NAEP, which stands for the National Assessment of Education Progress, tests civics knowledge in 8th grade every 4 years, 12th grade less regularly, 4th grade also, but we don't receive any state-by-state data. And we have asked for that over the years and have been turned down. Because of this lack of specific knowledge, many states have developed their own civics tests. Some of them are the tests similar to what we use. Some schools, some states will use the 100 questions from the naturalization test. We only use 50. I don't need to tell you how important it is to improve our civic education. You've probably heard that 2/3 of Americans can't name the 3 branches of government. That 8th graders in 2014 NAEP test, only 23% scored at proficient or above. When asked to recall the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment, a majority could name only free speech. More than a third couldn't name any. This is important, more important than a news story. We often see the sort of jaywalking type questions and people can't answer them. We laugh about it. We cry about it. I'm a news junkie. I can tell you how often I've watched the news stories from all perspectives. I watch it all. I read it all. Where the disagreement is caused by a fundamental lack of our system. They don't know how a bill becomes a law. They don't know what level of branch of government they ought to be requesting help from. And just that causes, I think, a lot of the division in our country. And we know we need to do something. This seems like a small step, this process of we are giving the test already, now we're asking them to forward their scores in whatever manner the school district has set up. By reporting the test scores, the state would be able to target support where it's needed. We work with teachers and students and districts all over the state. And in fact, I'm really glad that the elementary principals are here. We have a project now working with some really top-notch elementary teachers to put together guides for elementary school so that they can beef up their own civic education. But to do that, they need training in how a bill becomes a law because they also don't have, you know, they aren't social studies master majors, and so that's helpful. This will help us help the state of Minnesota do a good job in servicing teachers. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Bloom. Are there questions for the testifier? Well, thank you for your work at your center. If you're providing this kind of help to teachers, that's just really what we need. And they can access us online, is that it, Ms. Bloom?
Yes, they can access online, and we do workshops.
And then is there a fee for your workshops,
no.
Ms. Bloom? Oh, that's excellent to know that we have that source for helping teachers with that part of the social studies curriculum. Representative Ward has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Do teachers get continuing education credit for these classes?
Ms. Bloom.
Representative, yes, they do.
Very good. Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Erdahl. I know. Oh, yes. So we might have some in the audience who'd like to say something. I forgot about you.
Just the positive comments.
I know you have to get going, but just hold off. Thank you, Ms. Bloom, for vacating, and we'll hear from concerns. And there might be others in the audience who want to testify as well. I'm sorry. I know that Representative Erdahl has told me he's got to be out of here by 9, so I'm watching the clock. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Oney, and say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Ado Shuni, Director of Government Relations. Thanks for the opportunity and a chance to connect briefly with Representative Erdahl around our concerns. I don't think it comes as any surprise to Representative Erdahl or the committee about the commissioner's feelings on the civics test based on the fact that we have our civic standards spread across our social studies standards and that students, feel the students are getting the education. Do appreciate the amendment. Provides a little bit more clarity and manageability around the expectation of the proposal. However, since we would be having to collect the data and districts would have to be sending it to us, we would have to create a system to be able to accept those data on the performance on the civics test and be able to report it out. So just want the committee to be cognizant of the fact that that's going to require some systems build-outs at the department, working between the department and Minute on that.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. Ms. Dietrich.
With the great faith I have in the Department of Education, I know they can do a fine job with that.
Welcome, Ms. Dietrich. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here with the on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. And first of all, I want to say that the Minnesota School Boards Association supports a well-rounded education at all grade levels, and also we also support locally developed curriculum and implementation of that curriculum. So I want to speak to one piece to this bill, though, today. What this bill does is it actually merges the civics test, which for some school boards, they are still, they have mixed emotions about being required to administer the test that we passed in 2016. And not that they don't value civics, it is just that they thought that administering that test in that particular way at a particular grade level creates a can create a message that they really don't want to send. And so what I want to speak to here more specifically, though, is that what we are doing in this bill is we are taking the civics test and we are merging it into the accountability system. We are publicly reporting this an aggregate score. And so let's just look back at our current accountability system. We get it from the World's Best Workforce and from ESSA. They are built on standardized tests that are test the standards for one particular year, not standards that are dispersed among all K-12, and then that they are valid, reliable, they have been test for bias, and they have been teacher reviewed, all sorts of things. So bringing this test into that accountability system, I think just goes a little bit too far at this time when we are still grappling with the mandated test of 2016. With that, Madam Chair, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Are there questions, Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little confused about what's the apparently negative message that this might be sending. I can't imagine what that would be, and I appreciate understanding it.
Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. What I was referring to was the number of students not passing that test or having to retake it, that teachers are not teaching these standards, or just that it can look this civics test as passed can send the wrong message about what is being taught and when in a system.
Representative Ward.
If I'm understanding what you're saying, I think that's a really sad statement, that we're not doing in our regular curriculum covering some really basic things in our government. So I hope that we're doing better than that.
Representative Ward, we have excellent standards in the civics part of social studies, and they start at kindergarten, because I've read them many times, so I know. Ms. Dietrich.
Yeah, thank you. And if I can just clarify, what we are speaking to here is that the standards being taught being closer to the tests and maybe tested, evaluated in a different way versus a test in 30 out of 50 questions in one particular year.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Are there any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak to this proposal? Thank you, Ms. Dietrich, and all who have spoken. Representative Erdahl, now you get to do your closing comments.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation. Certainly appreciate I'm sure future willingness of the School Board Association to work to make this work. The fact is this, and I know the school boards and everyone else should be concerned, that we have a very low proficiency rate in the state of Minnesota, lower than the state than the national average in dealing with civics. I understand that we have very fine standards throughout our curriculum, but somehow, some way, the way we're doing this isn't working. And what I have been doing and will continue to do is to raise the level of awareness and accountability until we are much more proficient in civics education. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And for those in the audience, Representative Erdahl is a retired social studies teacher, a writer, and quite renowned for his work in
all around
history.
Good guy.
So I understand his passion, and he's going off now to speak to a group who are talking about American Indian education. So I thank you, Representative Erdahl. With that, the chair lays over 3589 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Jessup. Before we begin that part of our meeting, Representative Barr, would you move the minutes for approval from March 13?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes from the March 13th meeting.
Representative Barr moves approval of the March 13 minutes. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 13 are approved. Representative Jessup, thank you for coming to the table. And will you say your name for the record? And the chair will move, so we don't forget to do this, House File 3692, to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Please begin.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Randy Jessup, and I am here before you to move House 3692, as you have stated, and also, Madam Chair, if we could consider an amendment to the bill.
Yes, committee, I will move the H3692A1 amendment, and I believe what that is, members, is clarification to line 11 after students, inserting between the and deleting in and inserting of and deleting no later than, so that this reads more clearly. And then on line 12, deleting everything after as and inserting exhibiting characteristics associated with dyslexia, which is a good clarifier. Is there any discussion about the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now we can hear your bill as you'd like it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say it was about a week and a half ago that we heard from Representative Linda Runbeck regarding dyslexia training for our teachers, and we had legislation before us that we were considering. And Representative May Quaid made a good comment, and she mentioned about, you know, we really should consider screening for dyslexia at an early age. So as a result of her suggestion, Representative Ward and myself met with Rachel Berger of Decoding Dyslexia Minnesota, as well as one of our testifiers, Rachel. And Rachel, I'm going to probably pronounce your name incorrectly. I want to say it was Adepa. Thank you. And we drafted this legislation before you with the opportunity and knowledge that screening of our children at a very young age is most beneficial to their future education. And the desired time frame is on the order of kindergarten screening, if possible, but certainly before second grade. So that is what you have before you. Madam Chair, I have a few testifiers that I would like to be able to speak this morning.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hello, my name is Kimberly Dumitrika. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing House File 3692 today. We thank you for the support we've received over the past 5 years from members on this bipartisan issue, and the support we received 2 weeks ago for professional development. Today we're here to discuss strengthening screening for characteristics of dyslexia under the current Read Well by Third Grade legislation. Studies show that early intervention is critical. Dyslexia is a neurobiological difference, and the pathways in the brain can rewire with structured literacy. Once a child is still struggling to read in third grade, they only have about a 25% chance of ever reading at grade level. Early identification and appropriate early remediation is essential in building these children up to grade level and in preserving their mental health. Whether identified or not, different sources estimate that between 5 and 20% of the population is on the dyslexia continuum. Even if we're looking at the low end of that statistic, we're still talking about one child in every classroom. You've heard stories from parents across the state who have struggled to navigate an equitable education for their dyslexic child in a setting that does not understand how to recognize or meet their needs. You've heard about a loss of a free and appropriate education, the financial burden, as well as the time commitments families make for tutoring and traveling away from their neighborhood schools. Undiagnosed and unremediated dyslexia also takes a toll on mental health. Imagine the damage done to a child's self-esteem as they realize that school, their job every day, is not a place that they can be successful despite trying. Imagine not understanding why you can't learn like your peers. Children with dyslexia can be remediated in general education. In structured literacy, is good instruction that benefits all students. They do not need to fall so far behind that they qualify for special education. By not identifying these children early, we spend more later for special education, for juvenile justice, and for mental health. There are simple checklists to screen for dyslexia. While not every child with dyslexia is identical, there are common characteristics. Dyslexia is a language-based disorder, and it affects more than just reading. For example, did you know that it's common for children with dyslexia to have trouble tying their shoes, to remember their left from their right, to have had delayed speech, to mix up multisyllabic words, and to not understand rhyming? When we talk about screening, we are not referring to a full neuropsychological evaluation to diagnose dyslexia. This would not require a psychologist, but a basic skills teacher. I've spoken to many parents across the state, and families are outraged that schools didn't flag or understand what should have been obvious warning signs if there had been an understanding of dyslexia. And families are heartbroken at the thought of the other classmates who are not identified and may never learn to read proficiently. This is an issue of inequitable resource distribution. This is dyslexia, and a lack of awareness costs children. With 43% of Minnesota students leaving third grade not reading proficiently, per the MCAs, we are failing our students. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of Minnesota students, we come before you because we want to ensure that every child is screened, not diagnosed, but screened for characteristics of dyslexia and is able to receive proper early remediation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And another testifier? Please say your name for the record.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Fisher, and I'm honored to speak with you again today, as I spoke with you a few weeks ago. As I shared with you then, I am currently the reading specialist at Excelsior Elementary in the Minnetonka School District. As a reading specialist, I've seen the difference that early intervention can make. The younger students are matched with the appropriate intervention, the faster they will make progress and significantly reduce the chances they will need to receive special education services because their gap has grown too big. The cost of special education is astronomically more. The signs are able to be seen as early as 5 years old. By being proactive instead of reactive, we can match students from the beginning with the strategy that works for the best for the way they learn. You may be wondering why early screening is necessary when we already have so many different reading assessments. What often happens is that many students have coping skills that help mask the issue until later. They might memorize the pattern of an early level book, use pictures to guess, or put enough pieces together to answer comprehension-based questions without solid reading skills. By having a way to screen students at this early age, we can see these deficits earlier and start appropriate instruction during the early grades, when literacy is still developing. I want to share a very brief story about one of my current kindergartners. Based on some early signs, she was matched with a Wilson program called Foundations, which is designed for the youngest learners and is based on Orton-Gillingham's strategies and principles. This student started intervention the sixth week of her kindergarten year and now knows all her letters, sounds, letter formation, and is ready to start putting sounds together to form words. Her success this year with the right kind of intervention has prevented her from having a loss of self-esteem, kept her gap from peers minimal, and set her up for success. We didn't wait for her to fail. We can do this for all learners across the state. If we use an early screening tool and match students to appropriate interventions, this success story could be duplicated thousands of times over. Dyslexia was first documented before 1900. It's long overdue to implement some early screening tools in our schools to help all readers achieve success. Thank you for your excitement and support for readers in Minnesota.
Thank you very much. And our next testifier, please say your name for the record and begin.
I'm Michelle Quickstead, Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you for welcoming me here today. My name is Michelle Quickstead, and I want to thank you for welcoming me back and allowing me the opportunity to share more of my professional and personal experiences with dyslexia. As I left this morning, my 9-year-old said, "Mom, Be epic for me." Here's my attempt. I am a teacher with a bachelor's degree in communication disorders. This is a degree speech-language pathologists get as an undergraduate. As I have also received a master's degree in early childhood special education and have been working for 20 years with children ages birth to 7 years of age. As an early intervention teacher, I have collaborated with over 100 preschool and kindergarten teachers and stand witness here today that when classrooms have implemented dyslexia best practices for pre-literacy activities, such as systematic multisensory approaches, their students' reading skills have far outpaced the classrooms that simply employ rote learning and repetition. Decades of comprehensive research show that children's earliest experiences play a critical role in brain development. The Center on Developing Child at Harvard University has summarized this research with a few key points. Neural circuits, which create the foundation for learning, behavior, and health, are most flexible or plastic during the first few years of life. According to the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, it takes 4 times as long to intervene in fourth grade as it does in late kindergarten. It is for this reason I have committed my career to helping as many children as I can in the most critical years of life. Through my review of the latest research, I have found there is no cure for dyslexia, but it can be overcome. I know this from personal experience. My fourth grade son, who has been diagnosed with dyslexia at the age of 6, is now reading at a fifth grade level. I noticed language processing difference in him as early as 18 months of age and started implementing multisensory pre-literacy approaches when he was only 3 years old. If children with dyslexia are identified early
evidence-based interventions and accommodations can change their lives for the better, allowing them to thrive at the most rigorous schools, colleges, and graduate programs. The Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity has done extensive research in developing checklists for signs of dyslexia, as previously mentioned. When they have difficulties with nursery rhymes or naming letters in the alphabet, mispronouncing words of familiar words, forgetting familiar words, or recognizing simple patterns like cat and bat as rhyming, it's this checklist that I recently reviewed with my 4-year-old preschool teacher. My son, who's 4-year-old, is also demonstrating signs of dyslexia. I shared my concerns with her, and she was so grateful for the information. She shared it with the entire Early Learning Center and asked that I come to speak with them. I want to close with my plea for you to consider dyslexia screening in early education. Children with dyslexia are bright and capable of learning to read with the right instruction. Screening can identify those students who are potentially at risk for reading failure. As a result, early intervention directly impacts reducing educational costs for our society and minimizing the need for special education services for children with disabilities. I want to express my sincere hope that I leave you without any doubts as to why early intervention is essential for changing the trajectory for thousands of children with dyslexia. Every child deserves a chance for the right instruction.
Thank you very much. It's great to have teachers telling us about real experiences. That is fantastic, the work that can be done, and parents as well.
Thank you.
Starting early. Welcome, Ms. Deppa. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Deppa, and I am the mother of 5 young children, 2 with dyslexia, and also school board director at Delano Schools. I always like to make clear that I'm not here speaking on behalf of the school that I represent, but the knowledge that I've gained there. When preparing my remarks for today, I went and met with some friends who teach in basic skills and Title I, as well as some of those classroom teachers. And I wanted to make sure that we were on the right track. And what I learned was the same thing we've seen in all of our surveys. Teachers want to know how to help their students succeed, and they are genuinely interested in anything that gets them there. I have shared with the committee earlier in previous hearings what it was like for both of my dyslexic children in the school system. My son Isaiah, who spent all of kindergarten not learning to spell his name, learning letters, or learning to read. And then my daughter Anna Marie, who is in kindergarten this year. We saw those signs right away and had her tested. By simply being able to identify her struggles, we're able to meet with her teachers and see that success in the classroom. And Anna Marie will leave kindergarten miles ahead of Isaiah. In fact, yesterday we learned she's actually at grade level. Situations like mine are where I believe the House File 3692 begins to relieve some of the equity issues in our public schools. Had Isaiah's teacher been told that he showed signs of dyslexia, she would have pulled him for effective remediation. How many students are going to go through these ineffective interventions, wasting school resources like my son, because no one knows they have the signs of dyslexia? How many children with dyslexia are now in special education because they fell just too far behind? As a school board member, I'm always concerned about unfunded mandates. I know this is something that must be weighing in the back of your heads as I speak. I can only imagine that thoughts like, this is a policy year, not a fiscal year. And how do we push an unfunded mandate on schools who just came to us saying fully fund special education are going through your head? I want to share with you a thought that may ease that. $9,000 is how much extra it costs per year to educate a child in special education. $1,200 to $2,500 is what it costs to do a full special education evaluation on a child. These evaluations involve everyone from your classroom teachers to your special ed department to your school nurse to your administration. In comparison, there are screeners on the market right now that cost $1 per student and can be done during the screening process that most schools use in their kindergarten year. These screens can be done by your basic skills teacher who's already in their screening. They can be done by a Title I teacher. They can be done by a regular classroom teacher. Our school could have paid $1 to identify my son and begin remediation. It cost us $2,200. I would argue that the time and money spent on screening students for the signs and traits of dyslexia will ultimately be cost-saving. It will allow our teachers to identify and help students early and effectively, in many cases before that need for special education arises. This leads to equity. Every student has the right to learn to read, and giving teachers the knowledge of who in their classroom shows traits of dyslexia is a big step towards those equitable outcomes in reading for all children, not just those who can afford it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Deppa. Are there questions for the testifiers? Representative Fryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, so I just, when we talk about dyslexia, I get really excited because, you know, I have dyslexia, and I knew that I had it. And the B and D's, yeah, how can you tell those apart? But you can be on that end of the spectrum where you cope. And so I guess I have a couple questions about identifying and catching all of our kids because so I never fell behind on reading level, and my daughter never fell behind on reading level, and my granddaughter is never going to fall behind on reading level, but we all have traits. Would we be diagnosed through the screening that, we have these issues that makes it different for how we learn how to read?
Who would like to take that, Ms. Deppa or Ms. Quickstead?
Go ahead.
Okay, Ms. Deppa.
Madam Chair. So the screener, first of all, we want to be clear, is not going to diagnose anybody.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to get into that issue. That's a doctor's evaluation. My son, who's in fourth grade, would not be caught by a screener right now. He just wouldn't because he's been remediated so far.
Mm-hmm.
But the screener is not going to just test that reading level. It's looking at things like right from left, the ability to tie shoes. The basic skills teacher that we have told me that she took 12 students of hers, and it caught every single one. And she knew they were dyslexic, but they don't have diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted to see if this screener would be effective. She also screened my son and my daughter, and she told me my son screened out. She goes, he's actually, you know, he wouldn't be picked up by that screener as a fourth grader with 3 years of tutoring. And so it probably will not catch everyone. We worry about over-screening.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If we diagnose kids who don't, or not diagnose, if we screen kids and say they have these traits and they don't have it, it's just as bad as not finding them.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit that we see, though, is that we know that structured literacy is an effective remediation across the board.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're instituting that, even with some of our students in our district who don't have dyslexia or don't show those traits, we're still seeing success. The structure is really critical for those students.
Ms. Fisher or Ms. Quickstead, do you want to add anything to that since you're in the classroom?
I would agree from a speech-language pathology standpoint. This is a language processing disorder. And so when you can screen for other things rather than just the reading pieces, it helps identify the processing piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Ms. Pryor was stating, many kids are mildly impacted, but that doesn't mean that they're not impacted. And the design of instruction for all children is beneficial, but what is neat about the systematic approach for instruction is that it helps all learners, and the instruction that we have right now is leaving out 20%. So this screening mm-hmm. helps reinforce that we do have kids that are learning to read differently.
Ms. Fisher.
And I would just say to Representative Pryor that we, right now, a lot of what we have in place misses those coping skill, or it misses the kids who have those coping skills, and a screening like this would really help to isolate those deficit areas before any of those strategies start to fail later on, or before some of those kids go through the struggle that they wouldn't have necessarily needed to go through to get to that success point.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pryor, follow up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I do have a couple more questions, which one of them is this legislation says at the end of kindergarten. And should it be at the beginning of kindergarten to start the screening?
Representative,
before, it says before the end of kindergarten.
Yes.
Should we say would it be advantageous to say at the start of kindergarten that we begin the screening?
And maybe we want input from the experts at the table. Ms. Deppa?
So my daughter was screened as a kindergartner, and it was effective. I think the intent was when we were working on this with Representative Ward, Representative Jessup, was to get that screening to start in kindergarten. We had talked about the beginning of the year, but no later than second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if the amendments clarified that or not.
Okay, and maybe that's where, thank you.
Ms. Fisher or Ms. Quickstead? The time when we should screen, because you mentioned earlier.
Well, preschool screening would be great.
Yes.
I think we're trying to attach it to something that would not add on additional cost or time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it makes sense for us to be efficient when most people are thinking about reading in kindergarten, but we know that through research that it can be identified earlier. It's less reliable the earlier you try to identify.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to add that I was initially pushing for part of the preschool screening, that it would be as early as possible. And not only is it maybe, I think you're saying, less reliable, but we would have to train people to administer this part of the test, to add it to the preschool screening. Mm-hmm. And so that was a barrier to trying to add that to the bill.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you for that input. Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jessup and to all the testifiers, I'm floored. I don't think I've ever had a meeting and then come to a committee and made a suggestion and have it turn into a bill. This is incredible, and I'm very excited to see this. My questions were mostly about the timeline as well, but Representative Ward kind of answered those questions. I think if I was going to look at timeline, maybe it would be closer to first grade instead of second grade, because we know that by the time kids get to third grade, if they're not there, it's kind of too late. But this is wonderful. I'm having a wonderful morning right now. Representative Jessup, Representative Ward, thank you so much for doing this. This is great.
Thank you, Representative May Quaid. We have other questions? No? Let's hear from those who may have concerns or would like to add to this discussion, who might be in the audience. Ms. Dietrich? Thank you very much. Great to have you here today to give this kind of professional input. Welcome. Say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to definitely make sure that we all understand that Minnesota School Boards Association supports early intervention and diagnosis in identifying barriers to reading and math very early on. We had, when we originally read the bill and the amendment, we did have some questions about the implementation and the timing and some of those things that have been addressed, and who would do the screening, at what grade levels, and some of those details, and it seems like some of those have been answered thus far. And the one that I thought was enlightening to me when I heard the testimony was that and I would like to add that I think maybe screening needs to be defined, especially in the K-12 system, because so many times we think of the word screening as in preschool screening, and so this uses the word screening, I think, in a little bit different way. And so the other thing is that the other school board member that spoke earlier identified our other concern, and that is, of course, cost. If you're going to implement a very widespread screening system into the K-12 system, there are going to be training costs and other costs associated with it, because I would guess it would be more than just K-12 teachers that would need to be familiar with this checklist. And so we would be also very concerned about the cost and to make sure that it does get funded so that it gets implemented correctly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Are there questions for the testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would funding just to help do the initial training be helpful and not maybe like ongoing funding for every single year?
Ms. Dietrich.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think that any time you want to train and you want to make sure that there are no loopholes in it for the longevity, you need to have ongoing training for new teachers, new information, new research, that type of thing.
Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Deepa, correct, she talked about there's screeners out there that can do it like for $1 per child. Could school districts work with those very low-cost folks instead of maybe training themselves? Is that possible?
Ms. Dietrich.
Madam Chair, I would need to leave that up to other people. I'm not really qualified to answer that. But, yes. Thank you.
I think Mr. Aronson wants to come forward, too.
Madam Chair, because we have the 15 elementary principals here today, we thought we'd have one of the principals just visit with the committee for a minute about this.
I think that would be just great. Representative Lee, did you have a question for Ms. Dietrich?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure it's for her or the previous testifier, but I could wait.
You'll wait? Okay,
yep.
Thank you. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin and comment on this proposal that's before us. It is going to finance, so it will be looked at for cost.
Good morning. My name is Dawn Brown. I'm elementary principal at Washington Learning Center in New Ulm. And my building is a pre-K kindergarten building, so we're early learning center, basically. And we do monthly preschool screenings there. And whenever we see our children that have those signs, that is something that we are going to take a look at to try to screen all children and try to look at what their needs are. And we have a very strong early childhood special education team in our building that is constantly looking at that. We meet on a weekly basis to review our children to see how they're doing. And they work very cooperatively with our preschool teachers in our building and our kindergarten team in our building. And we are going to try to do our best in order to screen all of the children that may have dyslexia and address their needs in our building. So it is something that we're doing. And we will continue to try to support all of our children to get them to grade level.
Questions for Ms. Brown? Since we have one who's absolutely out there in the field today.
Thank you very much for sharing that with. Oh, Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As you mentioned that you're in the field right now, so are you? What percentage of children are you screening and catching? Recognizing that they have this issue, the dyslexia.
Ms. Brown.
Yes, in our district, it's very low at this time, so the percentages are very low. So we don't have a large issue in there, but it is a topic of conversation. It is something that we continue to talk about and that we are continuing to watch for.
Representative Breyer.
May I just follow up? And do you think it's because you don't have the tools right now to catch more children, or that, that we have to also take responsibility for, that we think that maybe this is an issue and that it's widespread, maybe up to 20% that we should be catching, but maybe, you know, maybe we might try to overcompensate and try to direct more children into that kind of screening than we need to. So can you, do you think that there is the potential to screen more children for this issue?
Ms. Brown.
I think we are all still learning about the dyslexia. Mm-hmm. All of our educators are special educators, and I don't know if screening all children who aren't making grade level is necessarily the right thing to do, just because all of our children are coming with such diverse backgrounds, mm-hmm. and it's not always dyslexia that's causing them to be behind grade level. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we see in our children in the early learning years are a lot of mental health, a lot of environmental issues that are impacting them, and we're trying to work with that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important that we really take a look at each individual child to see what their needs are and look for those characteristics like were spoken of earlier to see if that's what it is. And we're going to do our best to screen children in any of those capacities, you know, to find out exactly what it is that's causing them to get behind grade level and not to be able to learn like their peers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Brown. Representative Lee, would you have a question for Ms. Brown? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was curious how this will be communicated with our EL families and students, and if this has been considered by Representative Jessup or the previous testifier too.
Ms. Brown.
Yes. We're going to work with our English language learner families just like we would with our regular English language speakers. We're going to have our ELL teachers communicate with that with them. We will work with them. We have translators available if needed. We have an IEP meeting coming up where we have our translators coming to this next week. Any of those issues would be addressed for them in their language. If that's, is that what you're looking to have answered? I'm not quite sure with the question.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for me, this goes back to the point about defining what is screening or diagnosing too, because mm-hmm. I think that this will be a concern with some of our EL parents, mm-hmm. where if we maybe misdiagnose, or if we're not diagnosing but we're screening, how could we make that clear to them so that they understand that?
Ms. Brown, that was a good question.
Yes, exactly. We make it clear when we meet with families that we cannot diagnose, and that any diagnosis would have to come from a medical professional, and that we can only screen and we can only use our tools that we have to make an educational
judgment on where they're at. So it's, you know, we'll explain that to any family that we work with. No matter what the language is, we're going to try to make that clear and have interpreters there for those who don't speak English so that they are very clear on that as well, that we can't make a diagnosis. We only screen for what we can do, and then we can provide interventions as needed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brown, and thank you again, school leaders, for being here.
Thank you.
Because you're helping those teachers who are in our audience to know what is best for all of our children. Representative Jessup, I think we can go to closing comments because we need to get to the charter school bill. Closing comments, please.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and committee, thank you very much for consideration. One just final point is the effective date for this pending legislation would be July 1 of 2019. It would not be this summer. It would be 2019. And the reason for that is we heard from Representative Linda Runbeck's bill that we are looking for training for teachers, 2 hours of dyslexia training over this next year. And the idea would be is that we would transition into screening once our teachers have the training. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. With that, the chair renews the motion that 3692, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Let's move to House File 1580. Members, that is a chair's proposal, and I'd like to call to the table Eugene Piccolo, who is the executive director of MACS. He's going to walk us through 1580, so the chair will move 1580, and the chair will move, so the bill's in the order in which Mr. Piccolo is going to explain it, the A180599 amendment. And members, this is an amendment that is the result of a meeting of charter school persons, leaders, interested parties, so that we could hone down 1580 to a place where we have good policy ready to enact for the coming years for charter schools. So is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A18 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Welcome, Mr. Piccolo, to the testifying table and taking on this big job of walking us through 1580 as amended. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. First, we want to thank Representative Erickson for bringing forth this bill and her longstanding support for updating Minnesota's charter school law, which has been a model law for the country and has always been ranked in the top three charter school laws in the United States. Because its ranking is because we primarily continue to update the law to reflect and address the lived experience of charter schools and the new challenges that occur in the charter school realm. This legislation continues that tradition by addressing the growing development of charter management organizations, education management organizations, and online education management providers, as well as the lived experience related to charter school governance, mergers of charter schools, and the change or transfer of authorizers, as well as a few other smaller issues. This legislation raises expectations for charter school boards, provides clarity for the merger of charter schools, and for the process of transfer or change of authorizers by schools, and establishes standards for accountability and transparency in contracts between schools and charter school management organizations and education management organizations and online education providers. So let me quickly walk through the sections of the bill. Section 1 on pages 1 and 2 basically provide definitions of what a charter management organization is, what an EMO is, and what an online education service provider is. This is important because we've actually had in law a requirement that schools report their management agreements, but it's never been clear what management agreements they have to provide, And also now, states are required to report the number of online providers, CMOs and EMOs, to the Federal Department of Education. Section 2 basically gets rid of a provision that says that authorizers have to commit to serving as for a full five-year term. There is a provision in the law that says they can withdraw on 16 months' notice, so there's no purpose in having a requirement that can't be you can't hold them to in the first place. Section 3 is the language about mergers and lays out some criteria for what kind of schools can merge with each other if there's issues there. Section 4 basically says that term of office for charter school boards, it begins on July 1st. Currently, we have boards that begin their terms in 10 different months of the year, and there's a cycle of governance that kind of flows with the fiscal year, and so therefore we want to make sure that this is one way of improving governance. Section 5 deals with the membership of a board and the structure of boards, and just clarifies that teachers who are on the board have to be actually teaching in the school, not serving in an administrative position. Section 6 clarifies the process, the legal process for changing board structure. Section 7 actually raises the expectations for board members in terms of their training by requiring them to take a basic class before they can be seated on the role of a board of directors and the responsibilities, and then adds a new requirement that boards have to take some kind of training on student performance, achievement, and outcomes, because that's what schools are about. And boards need to know what their role is in that oversight of that area. Section 8 basically says that when there is a hearing for closing a school, it has to be recorded. Section 9 deals with the change or transfer of authorizers between the schools and lays out the four different scenarios. This also incorporates language from House File 1820, which Representative Erickson also authorized, which allows a charter school, if they're in good standing with their authorizer at the end of the contract, to find a new authorizer. And if they don't find a new authorizer, basically they go out of business. So we don't expect many people to do that, because in some ways it's a suicide pact they've put on themselves. Section 10 clarifies two things. One, about that the schools cannot or their agents not give out any incentives for enrollment, and also clarifies when a student actually withdraws to make it match the language in the compulsory attendance law. Section 11 begins the issue, clarifies that issue about what management contracts have to be submitted to the department as part of the school's audit, annual audit, and then goes on to lay out on page 11 the accountability and reporting requirements and transparency for these contracts between CMOs, EMOs, and online providers and schools. Basically, these can be worth a significant amount of money, because these companies come in and actually manage the school. And so we want to make sure that everybody's clear what money is going out there and what it's being spent for, and that there's a public notice about this happening. So there's real transparency in that. And then there's some requirements of what cannot be agreed to. On page 13, cannot be in the contract, that they cannot be lending money to schools to enter into these contracts. And we've had that occur once already. And we're trying to put a stop to these practices before they become too widespread. The section 12 is that schools have to document their efforts to outreach to low-income families, community of students of color, and students at risk, and then repeals the current section, subdivision 5 of the law, and that's replaced by that section 9 in the delete all amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Are there questions for Mr. Piccolo? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're talking about mergers of schools,
yes.
The language that you have now or what we have in statute, would it cover if a charter school were merging with a school district?
No.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, it would not cover mergers between a district and a charter school. This really only covers mergers between two charter schools,
okay,
which has occurred a couple times, and there's been kind of ad hoc processes, and so this just kind of puts some parameters around how that occurs.
Representative Pryor.
And as a follow-up, and perhaps this was for
Ms. Para.
For Ms. Para, is there anything in the language that we're writing now that would prohibit a charter school from merging with the public school system?
Ms. Para?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, I don't believe anything in these changes would prohibit that.
Ms. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in existing statutes?
Madam Chair. Chair, Representative Pryor, I don't recall right now what statute provides, but I can check on that.
And if I then redirect a follow-up then. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you think that if we is there anything that we would need to clarify if this were to take place of a public school, of a charter school merging with a public school, that we would need to write legislation surrounding that contingency?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, yes, there would be a requirement for new legislation or an amendment to the current law, because if a charter school closes, it has to liquidate its assets, and all assets go back to the state treasury under current law.
Representative Pryor, does that satisfy?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Piccolo? Representative Maquette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pickle, and this is going to be mostly because I never went to a charter school and I'm a freshman, so I apologize if everyone else on the committee knows the answers. And so I was reading in the House research that EMOs, or educational management organizations, are for-profit entities. Yeah. How do they make their profit?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative McQuaid, the EMOs make their profit by the fee they charge, and obviously they charge a higher fee to include a profit margin for their services.
Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And they're charging the fee to the charter school, correct?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative McQuaid, that is true, yes.
Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Piccolo, the money that charter schools get, they're public dollars, correct?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative McQuaid, charter schools are public schools, and they do get state money mm-hmm. and federal money. They do not get local property tax money, but they are public schools, and yes, so it is public money that is going to a private organization.
Mr. Piccolo, do we have an EMO in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, yes, we have two EMOs at the current time. One is called Athlos, which has a school in Brooklyn Park, and one in St. Cloud. Mm-hmm. And the other EMO is called, I forget what its name is, right off the bat. But there's another one, and there's also four CMOs. Minnesota has not had a tradition of CMOs and EMOs like many states, where the vast majority of schools are run by CMOs and EMOs. Our tradition has always been what are called ma and pa charter schools, because they're created by the people in the community, by parents, teachers, and community members, rather than some corporation that comes in and puts up schools all over the place. And that has always been, I think, one of the strengths of Minnesota, but we are facing the same pressures now, and that's why we need this legislation to be able to put some, at least, transparency and accountability of what's going on with these CMOs and EMOs.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Mr. McKenzie from the Association of Charter School Authorizers, I believe you're in the audience. Would you come forward? You would like to comment, and maybe that will help Representative Makewaite understand, too, the EMO issue that she's raised. Welcome to our committee, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Larry McKenzie here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Charter School Authorizers.
Please proceed.
And so first I'd like to say, again, thank you as well on behalf of the Charter School Authorizers for your work with charter schools. I want to go on record as saying that the previous bill, I know it is the lead all, but had a description of the roles of and responsibility of authorizers, and we would just like to, if there's any further discussion, to go on record to say that we would like to be included in those conversations moving forward. Two, we're here to express a concern in regards to the transfer language that starts on line 7.26 that allows charters, that allows for schools to transfer authorizers at the end of the contract term for a couple of reasons. First, under the proposed language, schools in corrective action would be allowed to transfer without consequences. Subdivision 4 references schools that are entering the closure process. That means that a school cannot freely transfer, that schools can freely transfer as a way to avoid closure. And so our concern is that schools that are in corrective action would then be or have ranges of intervention would be allowed to transfer without really any restrictions. And so that's a concern in regards to that. And we feel that that's is in conflict with accountability. And secondly,
Mr. McKenzie, which subdivision was that again?
Subdivision 4.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Isn't it the delete all?
It's 5.
If you use the delete all.
Yeah, that was the last one. So, okay. And farther, the proposed open transfer transfer policy incentivizes authorizers to lower their accountability standards in order to appease schools for subsequent contracts. Authorizers maintain a high level of accountability authorizers with high level of accountability will stand to lose out, and we're concerned about the possible race to the bottom with schools having authorizing shopping. Lastly,
so Mr. McKenzie, your Section 8 and Section 9, and of that, Section 8 Subdivision 4 and of 9 Subdivision 5A, is that correct, that you're raising concerns about?
It's line 7.26.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Madam Chair. And then lastly, we just most recently received the lead-all bill, and the authorizers are currently reviewing the rest of the changes made to the lead-all amendment and would like to go on record just saying that we will provide additional comments and concerns to the committee by the end of next week.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McKenzie. Mr. Piccolo.
In terms of line 7.26 and 7, it says, if at the end of contract the charter school board votes not to renew its contract with the author and is not subject to action of the authorizer subdivision 4, which is adverse action, that means they're under sanctions or possible closure, then they may notify the authorizer they intend to seek a new authorizer. So this does not allow a school who is under disciplined by their authorizer to transfer authorizers.
So Mr. Piccolo will make sure that this language is very clear.
Madam Chair, my understanding is Subdivision 4 does not include corrective action, that it is just a revocation of a charter.
Yes. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McKenzie? We have Mr. Sellers. Stay there, Mr. McKenzie, because we may have more questions, but Daniel Sellers is going to join us.
Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Daniel Sellers, Executive Director with EdAllies, statewide education advocacy nonprofit working to ensure all students have access to a rigorous and engaging education. I'll keep my comments brief and just say that I share Mr. McKenzie's concerns with within Section 9, Subdivision 5A, Line 7.26. Schools that are subject to action under Subdivision 4 would not be eligible to transfer, but we worry that just giving schools the opportunity to transfer authorizers without permission or without mutual agreement from the authorizers does may lead to an avoidance of accountability. And you've got that we believe that we need more accountability in the charter sector, not less. And the idea that that charter schools can leave an authorizer that they may not they may feel like is providing too much accountability to find one that is providing less accountability, like Mr. McKenzie said, we believe could lead to a race to the bottom. Current law requires mutual agreement between the charter school and authorizer, and I actually worry both from the charter school provision but also from the authorizer position that this provision could encourage authorizers to lower instead of raise their standards for accountability for charter schools. As a means to attract potentially underperforming charter schools, those schools that need the highest level of accountability, and in a means to attract them to leave one authorizer and come over to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sellers. Are there questions for Mr. Sellers? Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, there is no race to the bottom. At one time we had 51 authorizers. We will be down to 13 authorizers next year because authorizers are leaving the field because of the requirements on them. So there is no race to the bottom. There is no contracts are supposed to be mutual, equal parties. When one party has all the power to determine whether or not the other party can enter into the agreement, there is no valid contract under law. So all this does is say that if a charter school is in good standing with their authorizer, at the end of their contract, they can transfer authorizers. And if they cannot find an authorizer, because they have to give notice, if they cannot find a new authorizer, they go out of business. So it would be the school board basically saying, we don't want to stay in business if we can't find an authorizer. I can't believe there are that many school boards that are that kind of would take action that serious that would put them in jeopardy in terms of their existence.
Well, members, you can see that charter schools can get pretty interesting here. We don't have agreement, and gentlemen, you're going to have to work this out if I'm going to include any of this in the omnibus bill. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify with concerns or with support? Okay, members, I'll make my closing comments, and thank you, Mr. Piccolo, for being here, Mr. McKenzie, and Mr. Sellers. Representative Kunesh-Padin, did you have a question for a testifier? Oh, we have somebody else joining us. Who did you want to ask?
I'm sorry. For
Mr. Piccolo?
Yes, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. You said that authorizers went from what to 13?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative. At one time we had 51 authorizers. We're now, as of next year, we'll be down to 13.
Can you explain what caused that reduction, Mr. Pace?
Well, thank you. Madam Chair, Representative. A couple different things. One, in 2009, actually this legislature did a major overhaul of the law. And one of the provisions in that was to change from the concept of sponsors to authorizers. Because sponsors were seen as kind of that they just signed their name on the paper that they were going to sponsor the school. And there were sponsors, some were school districts, some were nonprofits and others, who actually never even stepped foot in the building that they were supposed to be overseeing. So in 2009, the law was changed to say, okay, we're moving from this concept of sponsors, which people thought Well, that means their friend and their buddy and stuff to say no. They're actually an authority, have some authority. And part of that was they had to demonstrate they had some processes, that they had some capacity to do this, the job of oversight. And it also put in a requirement that every 5 years, the authorizer's performance will be reviewed by the Department of Education, so that if an authorizer was not doing its job, it could be put out of the authorizing business. And we had a number of organizations, both school districts and nonprofits and colleges, who said we don't want to do all that extra work of coming up with processes and so forth, and so they've left the field.
Representative Kunesh-Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like this is a lot of work for these authorizers.
Yes.
And that there are pretty stringent expectations from these authorizers that they are not willing to put forth. My question is, are they compensated for something like that?
Mr. Pickle.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, authorizers do get a fee from the schools they authorize. It is a minimum of one pupil unit. So this year, that would be, this coming year, would be $6,312.
Correct.
Up to a maximum of four pupil units, which would be $24,000 something or other, without doing quick math in my head. Or if they're somewhere in between, it's a per pupil amount that's connected to the formula. So, yes, they do get compensated, and the schools actually compensate them for doing the oversight, their oversight role.
Representative Kunesh-Padin.
Madam Chair, thank you. And so these funds are public dollars that are going to the charter school, and then the charter school is compensating the authorizers. Am I correct?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Hello.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is true.
And that formula, would you just repeat that for me one more time? I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's okay.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative, the formula is a minimum of one pupil unit.
And for charter schools, that is?
It's the state pupil unit, so next year it's $6,312. And the maximum is four pupil units. So $25,000, whatever it is.
You said 24 plus.
Plus. Or if the school, because it's by also size of the enrollment of the school, it's also a per pupil amount in between those two. So every school pays a different amount depending on their enrollment.
Members, do you think you're going to have more questions when we reconvene after session? Because, Mr. Piccolo, maybe you could return. And Mr. McKenzie or Mr. Sellers, because I can just lay this bill over now and we can just get more questions answered. Members, do you think so? Mr. Piccolo?
Sure.
That will be okay?
Sure.
Because, members, we're going to have to stand in recess now until the call of the chair, and we hope at 5 o'clock in this room to reconvene and finish our debate on this charter school proposal and hear the last three bills. This meeting stands in recess. Our meeting will resume. This is Education Innovation Policy. And Mr. Piccolo, do you want to come to the testifying table? Mr. Piccolo has brought a primer on Minnesota charter schools. We thought we should take just a few minutes to review this public school concept, because members, this is public school, and he would like to walk us through it. And in regard to the question that was asked this morning about authorizer fees, keep in mind that public schools also have contracts outside their regular school responsibilities, so it's probably pretty even between charters and publics when they get all of their contracts in place that are above and beyond what is required. So welcome, Mr. Piccolo. Would you walk us through this primer, please?
Madam Chair, my name is Eugene Piccolo, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Members, charter schools are tuition-free, independent public schools that are open to everyone, every student in the state, no matter their ability or need, and they're governed by a jointly boards of, composed of teachers, parents, and community members. As you may know, Minnesota was the birthplace of chartering back in 1991, and today there are 43 states in the District of Columbia and foreign countries that have charter schools that are all based on the concept that this legislature adopted in 1991. In fact, just in a little side, last year we had a delegation of charter school directors from Brazil come and visit and spent a half a day at our office to learn about how charter schools operate in Minnesota. And it was funny because it was the first day we had snow, and they had never seen snow in their life. So, and in our office, the windows opened, so we opened the windows so they could put their hands out and catch snow. There are 164 schools operating this year in Minnesota, enrolling about over 56,000 students, which is about 6.5% of all public school students in the state. And there's schools from Grand Portage in the far northeast to La Crescent in the southeast to Echo, Minnesota in the southwest to Bemidji in the northwest. Most of the schools, though, are about two-thirds of the schools are in the metropolitan area, the seven-county metropolitan area. There's some basic, the basic facts are they're public schools, tuition-free. They may not have any entrance exams or requirements to get in. They may not limit admission to pupils on the basis of intellectual ability, measures of achievement, aptitude, or athletic ability, and they must accept students up to their capacity. Now, they can set the capacity by total number of students and by grade, and if there are more students than there are slots, they have to have a lottery. And the schools, by law, must publish their lottery policy and the dates it occurs and so forth so that everybody knows what it is. And when there is an opening, they have to go in order of the kids in the lottery. So there's no preferences there. They are subject to the human rights law, the pupil fair dismissal law, the public school fee law, the data practices law, the general employment law, all federal, state, and local health and safety laws, state testing requirements, et cetera. They have to follow the same requirements as districts for special education because they are districts, which means they all must have a licensed special ed director, and many of them join co-ops, the regional service co-ops, or there's a kind of a co-op of charter schools that serves about 80 schools for that purpose, and some of them contract with private companies to do the special administration. They do receive less funding per pupil than traditional districts because they cannot levy property taxes. The last time a study was done about charter school finances, on a statewide basis, charter schools get about 10% less per student than traditional districts. In St. Paul, it's about 24% less. In Minneapolis, it's closer to 30% because of the property taxes and so forth. Every charter school is a nonprofit corporation under Minnesota Statute 317A, and they are also 501c3 tax-exempt organizations. As I mentioned, their boards are composed of parents, community members, and teachers. It's only licensed teachers on staff who can be on the board. Other staff cannot be on the board. They are required to meet the open meeting law on how they operate as a board. They have a contract with an authorizer that has performance goals for academics, for finances, for operations, and other goals that they might choose to have. They have an authorizer, and in Minnesota, there's colleges and universities can be authorizers, traditional school districts can be authorizers, nonprofits can be authorizers, and then about 5-6 years ago, the legislature created a category of authorizers called single-purpose authorizers. They are nonprofit organizations who have been created for the sole purpose of being an authorizer, unlike a traditional nonprofit. So if they ever stop being an authorizer, they go out of business. And we have four of those. One of them was actually created by the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers to be an authorizer. All of our teachers must have a valid teaching license. They have to follow all the same financial requirements, UFARs, MARS, STARS, all those things, and they do an audit every year that has to be submitted to the commissioner by December 31st, and they can be penalized if they don't get it in on time financially. Most of them have a specific focus or program. You'll see on the backside a list of those, and we'll get to that. Normally, our schools are smaller in size, and we have, out of the 164 schools, a quarter of them are under 100 students. And the average charter school in Minnesota is about 360 students. We do have more diverse enrollment than statewide averages, and we'll talk about that in a second. And currently, there's 14 authorizers, and the statutory reference is 124E. If you want to turn to the statistics, we have 54% of our students are free and reduced compared to the statewide average of 37%. We have 21% of our students are limited English students versus 8% statewide. 59% of our students are minority versus 33% statewide. And the 13.5% of our students are special ed compared to 14.1% on the statewide basis. We've grown significantly in the last few years. There are 17 schools that have been approved to open this fall. Not all of them will open. Not every year there are schools that get approved but never come to be because they never get their act together, basically, to be honest with you. And then you can see the different grade configurations of schools. Charter schools only have to have one grade by law. But most schools have, obviously, multiple grades, otherwise they never exist. We have 27 schools with approved pre-K programs now. And you can see the distribution of where the schools are across the state. There's also a listing of some of the kinds of programs our schools have. We have about 9,000 employees in the state pension plans because charter school employees must pay into TRA or PERA. So licensed teachers are in TRA and everybody else is in PERA. We lease over 6.7 million square feet because charter schools by law cannot own a building using public money. So everybody leases space. We do have about 20-some schools that have affiliated building companies where they've created another nonprofit who either purchases or builds a building, and then they lease from that other nonprofit building company. And that was formalized in 2009 by the legislature after two legislative auditor reports in 2003 and 2008 said legislature addressed this issue because some people were looking at it as kind of quasi-appropriate or not. It is not the most it is not the best way to do facilities. We have had legislative proposals for several years now to do something different because, to be very blunt, it's a waste of resources the way we do it, and of both time and public money, because it's a very costly way of creating a building company. So at some day we hope that we'll pass the legislature and fix that. You can see the average price per square foot is about $12.19. The vast majority of schools provide their own transportation, either by contracting with the bus company, having their own buses, or reimbursing kids and giving bus passes in the metro area for high schools. And most of the schools that use district transportation are either in the suburbs or in rural Minnesota, where it makes absolutely no sense for everybody to have different buses, because in rural Minnesota, most of our schools are elementary. And so those kids are going to be in part, go back to the high school in the district anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. That was very good of you to bring us this primer so that you could walk through it with us. Are there questions for Mr. Piccolo? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on line 12.16.
Are we going to the bill, the delete all now?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, anything? Right. Any question on the primer? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, if I'm remembering right, it's somewhere 3 years or 5 years that a school has to be in existence before they can form this building project. So they have to have a track record of success before they can enter a building. Ms. Piccolo, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that is correct. It's, I believe, I've got to remember, it's either 5 or 6 years.
Any other questions on the primer? Representative Kunesh-Vadim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know who, where did I write that down? Oh, here it is. Who approves the opening of a charter school?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Kudish-Vadim.
KP.
KP. The process is a group of people come together to form a group that wants to start a charter school. They have to put a business plan together, and then they have to search for an authorizer, one of the authorizers. An authorizer will do a review of that application. They will do their due diligence and check the background of these people and so forth. And once, if they give approval, then the authorizer has to provide an affidavit to the commissioner outlining their due diligence of that application. And they are the commissioner follows the protocols that have been set in the approval of the authorizers originally. And so if they have followed everything, then the commissioner signs off the affidavit and the school is approved. And then at that point, the school group and the authorizer develop a charter contract which lays out performance goals, academic goals, financial goals, et cetera.
Representative Mariani.
Chair, Mr. Piccolo, if a charter school doesn't comply with its lease payments, for whatever reasons, maybe it shuts down prior to the end of the lease, who's on the hook for the lease payments to, is anyone on the hook for the lease payments?
Mr. Piccolo.
To the CMO or the MO?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, a couple years ago, the law was amended that when a charter school closes, all lease obligations end. And so the landlord is on the hook for anything. The school still has to pay for anything up to the day it closes, but beyond that, there's no financial obligation beyond that. So the landlord basically has a space again to rent.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just when you talk about the authorizers and the 14 authorizers that are out there right now, so that includes the for-profit authorizers, and are they the single-purpose authorizers?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative. Authorizers are not for-profit.
Okay.
Authorizers are school districts. Mm-hmm. We have three school districts that are authorizers. We have a couple colleges, Bethel, St. Kate's, St. Thomas. I'm thinking I'm missing one.
St. Scholastica?
No, they are no longer. Okay. And the rest are either regular nonprofits like the Audubon Center for the North Woods up in Sandstone is an authorizer, and they authorize schools that have an environmental base to it and so forth. And then there's the four single-purpose authorizers, which are nonprofits. One is called NEO, Novation Educational Opportunities. One is the Minnesota Guild of Public Charter Schools. One is IQS, which is innovative, I forget what it stands for. We just call it IQS. Mm-hmm. And who am I missing?
Volunteers of America.
No, they are regular, but they're a regular nonprofit. They're not a single purpose authorizer.
Single, you're on single purpose.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So there are 14, and they're all nonprofit organizations or school districts.
So just understanding the cheat sheet that you've given us, which I really appreciate, the basics, the operations, programs, authorizers. So is there another category then of that covers these for-profit ones?
Okay.
Mr. Piccolo, yes, he'll explain that.
Madam Chair and members and Representative Pryor, there's a difference between an authorizer and an EMO or CMO. An EMO is a company that the charter school board would hire to come in and manage the school. So that has nothing to do with the authorizers.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sorry. And the same thing for a CMO. They are a nonprofit company hired to come in and manage the school.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Piccolo? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak to this proposal, 1580, as amended? Or talk about charter schools specifically. Mr. Piccolo, I think you can do my closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just again, this bill in the delete all amendment basically focuses around three major things. One is to raise the expectations for boards and board governance by putting some additional requirements on the education needed by boards. Second, it clarifies the merger process for schools and also the transfer process for charter schools between authorizers, and also creates some accountability and a transparency in terms of contracts with CMOs and EMOs and online service providers. And we believe these are critical, important issues as the charter school movement continues to evolve over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. With that, the chair renews her motion that 1580 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Charter school box at
you missed it. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2860, a bill that requires the Commissioner of Education to review a representative sample of school district and charter school curricula for alignment with statewide academic standards, and upon request to assist a school district or charter school to modify a curriculum that is not aligned to statewide standards. The Commissioner is asked to report on the findings in an annual review to the legislature. And I have Amendment A1, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to move. So I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 2860. This is ensuring that the sampling by the commissioner is varied in size and geographic region across our state.
Uh,
Representative Erickson moves to move the amendment, H2860A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those nays? Motion passes.
And, Mr. Chair, I will be referring this bill to Education and Finance because there's going to be a cost, perhaps and surely, to the Department of Education. Members, the reason I'm bringing this proposal is that in 2016, and I think you have this pamphlet in blue and in black and white. I have it in color here. A report was released from the Wilder Research Foundation. They were commissioned by MDE to conduct an annual survey starting in 13, and they looked at how the standards, the statewide standards in language and math, were being implemented across the state. And you will notice on this handout that in 13, 710 schools, in 14, 749, in 15, 623, and then in 16, 721 completed the survey. That represented not quite 50% across the years of elementary, middle, high school, and charters that responded to this information about use of standards. And what was determined, and your chart on the back doesn't show it very well, but if according to the data that was collected, our standards and the MTSS components were to be fully implemented, it would take till 2064. So this alarmed me because if teachers don't understand the standards, then they probably haven't chosen the curriculum that will support them. Thus, my endeavor to have a survey done by the commissioner to find out why these standards haven't probably been implemented to the extent they should be, especially now that we have ESSA and our new federal accountability, and to find out what help might be needed out there. So, Mr. Chair, I think with that said, I'll stand for questions, or we can bring up our testifiers. I know the department wants to comment on the bill, and members, I do want to work with the department if we want this proposal to go forward. So leave it in your hands.
Any questions for Chair Erickson? Are there any testifiers? I know Mr. Ewing would like to testify. Come on down, please. State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Department of Education. I had the chance to connect with Representative Erickson on this proposal and discuss with the commissioner about the intent of the proposal. I think there's a wide recognition that it's important that districts are able to create curricula that implement the standards effectively. And we believe that the approach of a wide cast review or survey of districts for the implementation of standards in their curricula might be too broad and might be an approach that is more directed and more intentional would provide us with better success around the districts that actually need the assistance for the improved performance of their students. So instead of doing a representative sample of districts and charters and a representative sample of subject areas, which could result in 7 to 10 curricula being reviewed from each district of this sample of 10%, which may result in, you know, possibly needing extra staff. I personally was part of the World's Best Workforce Summary Review process, and I can tell you it's very intensive. We have a lot of staff members work on it. We brought in people from the regional centers to work on it. So I think this would add another layer to that. We also only have around 8 people in our standards division, so they're the real experts around division or district and charter curricula. But instead of doing a wide cast net to all districts that may or may not be performing well or meeting their goals, we could have assistance provided by the department to districts that identify under their needs assessment who are not meeting their performance goals. They do a needs assessment, and they evaluate that there's some technical assistance they could receive from the department on the implementations of their standards. So this could be very purposeful, directed assistance to those districts that know that they need it. And it would also, I think, get district buy-in to submitting their curriculum to the department. It would be much more of a collaborative process rather than maybe those districts that it is working for them and maybe they question why they're sending in their curriculum and having us review it. So with that, I could stand for any questions or take any comments.
Representative Urbel, you have a question.
Thank you. Some may think it's a question. Some might think it's a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Uni, do you think that this will in any way help us to understand why civics education is not being effectively taught in the state of Minnesota?
Would you like to respond, Mr. Uni?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, if through a needs assessment of the social studies standards, a district submits curricula around their social studies classes and it indicates that they're not meeting the civics standards that are sprinkled across the social studies standards through their grades, it's possible that in those districts that need assistance and achievement there, we could see whether they're achieving the correct implementation of standards around civics. It's possible.
I'm hopeful.
So I'm going to ask my testifier a question. Are you going to provide me with some good language then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we'd be more than happy to sit down with you, the author, and work through some language that could work. We'll talk more with the commissioner and talk more with our accountability and academic team and see what we can do.
And Mr. Annie, I'd like that by tomorrow.
Mr. Chair.
I have a house researcher who's working very hard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and staff, we will try to work as hard as we can to get language. If it's not perfect, we can continue to work on it as
correct,
we go forward.
Because I am referring this to finance, so thank you very much. Members, I wanted to show you the benchmarks just from language arts that are tested in the MCA tests, and this would be through grade 12. So it's this much of this handout. These are the K-12 language arts reading standards. And the benchmarks then, of course, begin primarily. There are benchmarks, of course, for kindergarten, but for the testing, they begin, of course, in grade 3. But that is incremental, and so it's important that our children are learning the standards from kindergarten on through the rest of their education. But, you know, to me, this is very critical. I always had a set of standards to which I taught when I taught high school English, even when I taught junior high English when I first started my career. And I don't know where I would be if I hadn't had a set of standards. Now, back in my day, because I started teaching in 1963, we wrote our own standards and then selected curriculum to support it. But I was lucky enough as a teacher to study under the late Dr. Madeline Hunter, who was a psychologist and an education professor out of UCLA. And I studied under her probably 15 years after I started teaching. And, in fact, it was in Atlanta, Georgia, where I started to study under her. I was telling Ms. Liffey, my CLA, that I loved Atlanta, but that was where I studied under Dr. Hunter. And you know, to know that you have these standards and then you can build, then you select your curriculum, which is the materials, and then you build your lesson every day based on that. You really, as a teacher, have a perfect way to always track your students' learning. And, you know, we're giving quizzes, we're giving tests, but you know in the presentation if, you know, after you've set the objective for the lesson, that their reaction to you and to your questions and to what you might model or whatever I was doing, especially when I was teaching writing, whether or not your students are learning. And that's what's so critical in our classrooms. We have great teachers, and I want them to have an understanding of these standards, but I also want them to have the curriculum that's going to match up to meet these standards. So that's my passion as a former teacher about this. And I will assure you I will work with Mr. Uni if we can figure something out. We'll include it in the omnibus bill. If we cannot, we might add it later. So with that, Mr. Chair, I've concluded my remarks. Maybe there are others in the audience who'd like to speak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any other questions for Mr. Uni before he leaves?
Pryor. Representative Pryor, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here we are. And just so what are the carrots or sticks that would move a school district to seek out this kind of evaluative help from the Department of Education?
Mr. Rooney.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. So that's a good question. We're ending our first three-year period under World's Best Workforce, where we're looking at how the districts have done for the local goals they've set for themselves and the progress they've made towards them, and also the progress they've made towards our overarching state goals. We're really evaluating them on their local goals. We haven't made final determinations about what exact ways the commissioner's help is going to come out. We do have authority to redirect 2% of general funds towards school improvement plans that are done in collaboration with school leadership. So it's not a takeaway, it's not a set aside, it's a redirect for school improvement, really to help them achieve the goals that they themselves set with their communities and their leadership teams and their teachers. So that's kind of the carrot and the stick there. I mean, the carrot and the stick is, you know, they will. Their performance on their World's Best Workforce goals show whether they've met their goals or not, and this is an opportunity for them to get the assistance they need to get their students to the achievement they want. So that it's kind of a carrot and a stick at the same time. It's a carrot stick or stick carrot.
Well, we do have carrots.
Yes, but those are the tools that exist. So we are going to kind of see through this first phase what that looks like in implementation. And we'll get a better idea of our experience with the tools we use from the department's perspective and how that works with the districts.
Follow-up, Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, you know, at that point, there are choices that would be made to how you structure it so that you encourage maybe more encouragement based on kind of our overall goals. And so it could be, you know, equity issues, and there could be that would be a very thoughtful and probably meaningful, or it could be very meaningful in how this encouragement, instead of being a random choice of schools, but an encouragement of certain, a profile of certain districts that would be the highest public priority for engaging in this.
Ms. Kearney.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The point of the World's Best Workforce Improvement Plans is really looking at those districts that need the most help and really doing the more intense work with them, the more they need the help, the more their students are behind. And, you know, this would be one of the areas. I also want to say that we're going to try to do our work under World's Best Workforce as we do it alongside our responsibilities under ESSA. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be bringing all our tools to the table. So that's not just the up to 2%. I should have said up to. It's not 2% guaranteed, and that's just a tool in the toolbox, not the only one. But we've got our regional centers out there, and our regional center workers are masters at curriculum in all areas. And they've been working with these school leadership teams, especially ones who've been identified for help right now, Title I schools. But they will most likely be recommending to those leadership teams, you should really take advantage of the support you can get from us and from the department around enhancing your curriculum. We see that the standards are not embedded to the level that they need to be to achieve well on our expectations in the state. One of the ways is how they perform on the MCAs, just one of the ways. So there'll be encouragement on the ground level as well to take advantage of this opportunity, should we go through with it.
Mr. Rooney, I have you've gotten several requests or a few requests from regional centers to help with the implementation of standards or the continuation, especially in school districts where we have large populations of new Americans or of those who do not speak English.
Mr. Rooney.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I know that just from my just short conversations with regional center employees that their work and their assistance is requested all the time. I don't have specific examples to the number, or I shouldn't say specific examples, but data on the number of districts they've been working with. I believe it's around 300, several hundred schools that they're working with right now, school sites. But I don't have the data on work with particularly with new Americans. But I can see if we can get that information.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney.
Any other questions for Mr. Rooney? All right. Mr. Bartholomew, would you like to take the podium?
Thank you.
Please say your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I'll be very quick given the time of day. As Representative Erickson mentioned, Minnesota has some of the best standards in the country, but we can't expect our students to benefit from those standards if they aren't taught. And another one of the findings in the Wilder survey was that only one, while our standards in English were adopted in 2010, by 2016, they were implemented only in 1 in 5 elementary schools, and for high schools, fewer than 1 in 10, 6 years later. And that rate has been fairly steady over the time that Wilder has been doing the survey. So we see a real need for House File 2860. We'd ask that you support it as a means to help our teachers and schools more effectively implement our standards. We thank Representative Erickson for introducing this bill and look forward to the conversations that she'll have with the department. But, again, we've got some of the best standards in the country, but if we aren't teaching them, our kids won't benefit from that. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bartholomew?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move that 2860 as amended be referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
All those in favor say yay.
Yay.
All those against say nay. Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, my next bill is a bill on statewide testing, and so I'd like to bring 2859 before us consider that for inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, again, because I am so concerned that our children get the opportunity to learn and to have good curriculum that's supporting our standards, I'm concerned that when we start testing, and testing is starting now in Minnesota, even when we start testing in March, that our students are not getting an opportunity to learn everything that is expected of them to advance to the next level, whether it's the next grade or the next course. So I am proposing, and I actually do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, I am proposing that to 2859, with this amendment, that we start our testing no sooner than or no earlier than April 15th, and that the commissioner publish a testing schedule at least 2 years before the beginning of the testing period. And then I've added another little item on page 6 of the delete all, that parents receive this information no more than 30 days after the district has administered the test. And then I have delineated some of what needs to be done as that report is delivered to our parents. And members, you know, I don't think we should be so concerned that these test results aren't used in the year in which the student is tested, but that they are adhered to as the child begins the next test year, because now the new teacher, or if it's the same teacher, will have that data available to know how to start the next year and really zero in on where the weaknesses and strengths of the students were. So I know there will probably be some question about this not before April 15th, and I think even Jennifer Dugan is here probably to address this. But I feel very strongly that we're leaving essential information out of a child's learning if we are testing so early in the year that they aren't getting the rest of the standards. And maybe teachers are returning to the standards and using their curriculum, but it seems to me that when the testing ends, we're into May, and there are a lot of activities that children then get to enjoy, and maybe they're missing out on an essential piece of learning. So that's my concern here, that the testing is occurring too early. I looked at my own district. Princeton is my home district, where I taught for a lot of years, and they are not beginning until
the 3rd of April, so that was comforting to me. But then I looked at the schedule for some other schools, well, the state schedule, for example. And remember, I'm only dealing with the MCAs here, not dealing with access or any other tests that might be given, like the MTAS. I'm just dealing with the MCA. But the window for testing in Minnesota this year opened on January 29th and continues through May 11th. And for the high school, actually, I think they can even extend beyond that. Then I looked at some other districts, small and large, where testing begins in April, so I didn't feel too badly about this April 15th deadline. And then I looked at other states, and other states do a variety of things. In Florida, it basically begins in April, but they also do some testing for end-of-course assessments, which is what I tend to call the MCAs, because they actually are testing the benchmarks of the standards for an entire year or an entire course or an entire unit. Across the nation, I would say that April becomes a very important testing month, and that they then test in some states where their school year exceeds ours and goes into June. They're testing well into June. So it looks to me like it's a culmination. It is the final summation of a child's learning that occurs, and to me that's important because that means they've covered the majority of everything that they're supposed to move that student to the next level or to ensure that the student has achieved at the level, at their highest level in that course or that class, whether it be reading or language arts, reading or math. Those are our two most important tests that we test 3 through 8, and then once in the high school for each of those. So, Mr. Chair, that's my presentation. And since I haven't moved the amendment yet, I'll move the DE1 amendment to 2859.
We move the H2859 DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those against say nay. Motion carries. Did you have testifiers that you want to bring up?
I'm sure there are people out there who want to testify to this. I do know that my delete all actually was a collaboration with another group. So you saw in my original that I moved all testing to May, but I compromised, and so I'm hoping that somebody's coming forward to talk about this. Thank you, Mr. Sellers.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Daniel Sellers, Executive Director with EdAllies. And let me first say I appreciate the bill coming up during the lull in the basketball games today. It's great. I'll be brief. Which is to say we've been working with Representative Erickson, and we want to thank her for introducing this important piece of legislation and considering our changes that show up in the DE1 amendment. The legislation does 4 things, and I'll note that each of those things actually build off of recommendations that came out of the statewide Office of Legislative Auditors report on student testing and also our national analysis of state assessments. The first of the 4 things is it would move the state testing window after April 1st. As Representative Erickson said, students taking their assessment near the end of the year are able to maximize their learning, and data would more accurately reflect their proficiency and growth. I'll note that as a former educator in North Carolina, we took our tests near the middle of May. And as an educator, a 6th grade math teacher in a tested subject, that was critical for me. I wish we had even more time. I wanted every single minute that I could have to make sure that I could cover as many standards as possible to make sure the kids were ready to succeed on that test. And I can't imagine having had the test like in March, for example, both because I wouldn't have had enough time to cover everything. And also, as we know, in some tested subjects, once that test is done and the kids feel like they've completed that, their eye is already sort of towards the next year, and I feel like there's lots of material still to cover as you go through the spring. So that's the reason to push the testing window back a little bit. Second, the bill would require educators to have access to their students' data before the school year begins. So according to the Office of Legislative Auditor, over 77% of teachers in Minnesota report that MCA data is useful, but more than half felt unprepared to analyze the data. So giving educators the data in a timely manner will help them develop strategies and plans for using that data as they go into the following school year. Third, this bill would send individual reports to parents in a timely manner. Currently, the Department of Education directs districts to send these reports. This bill would not only codify the process, but would bulk up the longitudinal data required to be shared with families, and would also create a new requirement for the state to provide recommendations for families to help improve their students' learning. And then finally, the fourth piece is the Department of Education will be required to publish their testing schedule at least 2 years in advance. So that's giving schools and districts a heads up about when they are allowed to do the testing. It's something that MDE is already doing. It's good practice. And to put it in law ensures that districts are given ample time to prepare well into the future. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for entertaining the legislation, and Representative Erickson for carrying this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sellers. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there any other testifiers that would like to come down? Ms. Ernie, make your way down.
Mr. Chair, members of the Oshawnee Department of Education, I want to apologize to Representative Erickson. I didn't have the opportunity to reach out on this. I was talking with the assessment team about some of the expectations in the bill, and we want to have a realistic expectation around being able to give data back to families. I know that's been a focus in the past few years about how can we improve our data back to our parents so they can look at the summertime as an opportunity for students to not fall behind or to catch up, and we value the importance of that effort. However, the timeline set out starting on 6.30, when we talk about the school district disseminating a testing report to the parent of each student no more than 30 days after the district, has a lot of moving parts to make that happen. The districts have to give us the data, which, and then the department needs to take the time to make sure that the data is final if we're getting it into parents' time. And we're asking for a rich set of data. So achievement level in each content area is one of the more straightforward points, but getting in the tracking of the students' performance history and progress towards career and college readiness, and then giving the districts the data so that they can suggest ways families can help meet students meet their exceed or academic standards. That most likely, when we want to get clean, final data, is going to take more than 30 days to turn around. My testing director here from the department to answer any technical questions around how that process works to provide a little bit more clarity from the district, but I just want to bring it to light for the author. And again, I apologize for not being able to connect on this earlier. Want to bring it to light that the timeline is, too aggressive for getting the final and clean data into the parent to the district and into the parents' hands for the intent of the bill.
Madam Chair, did you want to comment on that?
I want to ask Mr. Uri a question. That's why I like being there when I'm giving a bill, but I didn't think that was right today. So, Mr. Uri, I understand, though, that with the systems that we use now, the scores from the tests are basically known by the district almost immediately, within at least 24 hours, 48 hours.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, the scores are known immediately, but the final data, the clean final data where we've done the validations is not immediate, and that does take a significant amount of time.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Uni, I guess I'd like a little more detail about what takes so long to get the results to parents. I think it's a really important thing that parents have this data so they can work with so they can know where their students is at or where their students are at going into the summer, how they can work with them, and what sort of categories they might be falling behind in. This is critically important, and from my perspective, the test is online. Explain to me how it's not a spreadsheet that you compute in a mail merge.
Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, that's a fair question. One of the reasons why I have our testing director here, Ms. Dugan.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Jennifer Dugan. I'm the director for the Division of Statewide Testing at the Minnesota Department of Education. And it is correct that the immediate scores are available within an hour of the student completing the test. And so those scores are available to the school district within an hour. We do provide a PDF that could be printed out, and if the district chooses to, that information could be shared with the parent at the district's discretion as appropriate. There are, as Mr. Uni mentioned, there are several checks that we do go through before we finalize first the test score, and then also making sure that we've got the right student associated with that score and all of their historical information. And so we go through several key checks and key validations, as well as psychometric analysis to make sure that all of the item parameters are correct and that items were individual items were scored correctly, as well as the scale score is, or the student score is, consistent with all of the questions that they received, as well as their answer options for those. And so not only does MDE validate those, but we also have our vendor validate those and an independent third party that validates those as well, because we know how critical getting this right is, and we know that the downstream impact of these scores is in, not only in, for the school, but also in the accountability system. After the scores are validated, we do provide the individual level scores back to the district as soon as possible. Before we do that, though, we've got to make sure that we've got the right student associated with that individual test administration, and so the districts go through and they clean up their data. And so there are circumstances that we may have a test score associated with the student, but say that something happened during the test administration and I have a test score, but I really shouldn't have gotten a test score. Maybe they find out, you know, maybe I cheated, and they need to tell us that that score should be invalidated. There's a cleanup process where the districts are cleaning up their data and are giving us final information. And so that data cleanup on the district part is going on at the same time that we're going through the final score validations. And then all of that information is then merged to get to the process of providing the historical piece once we're sure we've got the right student and their state student ID associated with that score. Then we're linking that up with their prior performance so that that's all in one place, and then it is printed and then shipped to the district, so the district does not incur the cost of printing all of those paper reports to give out to parents.
Follow up, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I understand, so you're checking the validity of the data. How, in an average year or maybe the last few years, what's the average error rate that you find? So, I understand that, you know, sometimes the student might have cheated or maybe there's some sort of a problem, so the test score should be invalidated. So, I get that, but other than that, what's the rate of errors you find in why are those errors occurring?
Ms. Dugan.
Is that
right, correct? Dugan?
Dugan, yes.
Dugan, I'm sorry. Dugan.
That's okay. So you're asking about how frequently we're altering a student's score?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. So that does not happen frequently. And when we are finding that maybe an individual question for a small percentage of the students that scoring needs to be adjusted, then it's not altering their overall score greatly. It could impact. It has a greater likelihood of impacting their subscore performance. So for math, it would be like algebra, geometry, that kind of piece. But even when those anomalies are, I'm sorry, we're in testing, so I'm very superstitious right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you are.
Ingesting, I mean.
When we do find those anomalies, they are very rare. We're very fortunate. We do a lot of QC before the window ever opens. And so they are exceptionally rare. So maybe it's three questions out of all of the grade levels and subjects in a year affecting, I think last year it impacted fewer than 100 students total across all of the grades and subjects. So it is exceptionally rare, but it does happen, and we know that these scores mean a lot and are used in a lot of places, that the downstream consequence is it's important to get it right.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's exceptionally rare, so maybe 100 students out of I guess my first quick question, Mr. Chair, is so how many students take the MCA about every year? Just for a percentage context.
Ms. Dugan.
Thank you. We have about 1 million test records.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Christian?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, so a tiny percentage, and you said most of the time it affects their score very little, maybe the sub score a little more. So I guess a couple of questions. First of all, why do these errors occur? Is it a bug in the computer program? Is it is it a problem on the district's computer and you know their computers? Is it the vendor? Why are these errors occurring? And the other question is, if these scores, if it affects such a tiny percentage of students and it affects their scores not very much, you know, I understand, you know, corrections aren't ideal, but I'm worried we're missing out by not moving forward with getting these scores to parents quickly. We're missing out on a lot of value that greatly outweighs the downside of a few incorrect scores.
Ms. Dugan.
Thank you. So in the past few years, what has happened has actually been that in an open response question where a student is responding, most frequently where we've seen it in the most recent past has been in the math type-in answer. So we ask a question and the answer is numeric, and they can answer in the way that makes the most sense to the student, how they approach the problem. Okay. So there's multiple correct representations of that answer. And so most of the time what has happened is we have found that even though we've gone through field testing and thousands of students have seen that test question before, it's one or you know maybe it's 10 students that respond in a new way in that year. And so we need to actually add it. So it's not so much that it's a scoring error as it is we need to add a correct response that we deem as a unique approach to the question that we didn't have included in as a result of field testing. So okay. It's not so much an error as it is that wasn't listed as a correct option, and so it was scored as incorrect, and after the analysis we determined that it should have been scored as correct.
Well, Mr. Chair, I that makes sense. Thank you, you know, for that explanation. I would just say that I think the value of providing parents with this information is far outweighs, you know, minor score corrections that might have to come for a tiny percentage of students. And you know, I presumably, you know, the scores could have a big preliminary, you know, box on the results. I just think. I think parents and families are smart enough to understand that, and I think more information for parents is very valuable.
Representative Bush-Budin.
Thank you, Chair, and to the folks at the table. Just as a person that has experienced these tests for almost 8, 9, 10 years, if the MCAs are actually two separate tests, so you take a reading test and you take a math test. Mm-hmm. And my first question, and maybe you can all answer this, are these tests all online now? in every school across Minnesota. Thank you.
But there's no paper or pencil. I mean, can there be paper or pencil? I know the commissioner told me that she'd love to have paper and pencil available, but we can't do that with the way the test is organized right now, correct?
Ms. Duggan.
Thank you. So the all subjects and grade levels are administered primarily online. There are paper accommodations that are available for students. So maybe they have a medical condition where they can't interact with a screen. Yeah. Then there's a paper accommodation, or if they needed a large print or a Braille assessment, then there are paper accommodations in those cases. As Representative Erickson was mentioning, the state statute does require that the math and reading assessments be adaptive, which requires that the test be online. And so what that means is that the test is being created for the individual student as they are responding to the question. So it's adapting, it's creating the test as the student answers correctly or incorrectly to the specific questions.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, and so I'm trying to figure out how to lay this out. So let's say, like, in the school that I taught at, and I was the administrator for it, you have third, fourth, and fifth graders. They each classroom has to take the reading test, and it has to take the math class test. And let's say there's three classrooms of each grade level. So third, fourth, and fifth, that's 15, that's 30 testing sessions that you would want to get in between April 1st and the end of May. And generally in there, in that calendar of 2 months, there's usually spring break in there, and then there's also the holiday for Easter, which kind of cuts down on a lot of opportunities for that kind of testing. And I just want you all to understand what that's like. These tests, we scheduled at least 2 hours for every test. So out of a school day, each student is losing 2 or more hours of testing just for the math test and then just for the reading test. And then if they were missing or they didn't complete that test, we would have to schedule again for them to make up that. And so I agree with you, Chair Erickson, that later is better in the school year. And most schools that I know try to push their testing to the very end so they can get all of that, those standards, all that education in. And so I'm not saying that that's not a good idea, but I'm wondering, with all of these students having to do it, 1 million kids having to do it all online, would you expect Ms. Dugan, would you expect that they can do all of that in between April 1st and the end of May for the entire state without some kind of technology meltdown? Because I know there have been.
Ms. Dugan.
Thank you. So a few notes. As Representative Erickson was talking about end of course, I do think it's important to mention that many high schools, when they're administering the science test, they are taking advantage of the beginning of the testing window because if they're on a semesterized block, because if students completed their high school course that encompasses all of the life science standards, then they want to get them tested as close as possible to the completion of that course. And so what we see with science is that there's, especially with high school science, there's a lot of testing at the beginning of the testing window and mm-hmm. a lot of testing at the end of the testing window. And so the high school does mirror to some extent. To answer your question about the state's ability to administer the test. So last year in March, the OLA did release a report about standardized mm-hmm. testing, and mm-hmm. one of their charts in that report was talking about how they looked at how many days it took to test all students. And so by and large, the majority of, and so that they were looking at 2016 data. We saw, when we did an analysis, we saw a little bit of a shift as we moved to 2017. I think I'm hypothesizing why we saw a little bit of the frequency distribution shift. Was that more districts are going to one-to-one devices. So I think that does provide a little bit of more flexibility in the administrations. However, even with seeing that shift to less testing time, we looked at most districts are finishing testing in 25 days of testing. That's not, obviously not 25 calendar days. That's 5 weeks. Of testing. There were some that are still going into needing 26 or more days. And so we could absolutely provide those graphs to the committee if they like. But that would point to, you know, on a year that we would lose if we don't start testing until April 15th, depending on where everybody's spring break is laying out that year. They may have a substantial problem administering within that. I also think that saying that we have the entire month of May to test, districts may see it as that's on the calendar, same as we open the testing window in March, but not a lot of folks are taking advantage of the early portion of that window, the big driver, and when we close the testing window right now, is actually the Minnesota statutory obligation that the department release school report cards by September 1st every year. And so that September 1st deadline is really what drives when we close the testing window. And so right now, that's why we're closing the first Friday in May, to allow that entire process of districts cleaning up their data to be sure that we have everything associated with the right school, with the right student, before it gets used in accountability calculations. So if we, in thinking about this bill, if we were to think about, well, we've really got the entire month of May, then we would need to think about what's the impact to the school accountability portion of statute as well.
Thank you.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a lot of my question was just answered, and I appreciate that. And that's just really interesting, you know, and profoundly important, too, for what we're trying to do. So I, you know, it's so maybe, I guess, a comment that what we're saying in this legislation seems to be very important, which is actually give each child to get the maximum number of learning days, so that what we're measuring is actually their year in school and not something that's moved up earlier in the school. But it also seems like there might be a fiscal impact to be able to accomplish that. So a very important goal and a critical goal. And we're hearing about some changes that might need to be around, beginning with this idea of the availability of the technology to take the test. And I do remember hearing the report from the legislative auditors of you have to just keep coming into that that shared space and bringing kids in to take the test, and they're going nonstop. And the scheduling of that around that is a huge tax on the school and taking away from instruction. So that's one fiscal piece that we've heard now. And then this 30 days reporting to parents, that's a fiscal. I mean, that could be solved with resources to have more people working on it to turn it around faster. So it would be a question of, you know, legislative will to make that happen and the accountability to make that happen. And I think there's another fits. Everything costs money. But I think those are two areas. But that the effectiveness of the test and how we're using them and what we're using them for, especially as it serves the child, is important in this piece of legislation. And I hope that that the author does continue to work and that we get something that that fulfills the goal that we're trying to, that we all know is important and agree is important.
I didn't hear a question, so.
And the question was, am I right in my analysis of, of some of the things that I have assumed?
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask Ms. Dukin if she could remind us of the number of items in the just the language arts reading test for each grade. Do you know that off the top of your head? Third graders have how many questions?
It's a test. I think it's 52.
It is that many.
Operational, but I need to check so we can get, we'll get those.
But that includes the adaptive. That's not the what I would call the base. No?
I'll get the full test design.
I thought it was more like 30, and then there were those variables.
I'll get it. I'll get the exact ones.
I think that would be interesting for us to know at some point. So I have another question for Ms. Duke and Mr. Uni as well. So turning to page 6 and the requirements, aside from a testing date change, how realistic is it to ensure that these items can be included as accountability pieces if the testing date is not changed? You know, identify the student's achievement level, track the student's performance history, suggest ways families can help students. I mean, this is coming from the school district, obviously, but are they going to have enough information at any time in the report that they're provided to be able to fulfill this?
Ms. Duggan.
Thank you. So a school district has right now, so if they tested a student today,
yes,
they have today the student's achievement level on, as well as their sub-score performance in that score report. And it is marked as preliminary, yes. and that could go home with, if the district chose, that could go home to the parent today. The tracking of the student's performance history and progress towards career and college readiness, that we would need the district to, that requires the district to clean up the data, that district time, to clean up all of the data to make sure that we've got the right student with the right test record with that administration. And then we link that to all of their prior performance history, and then that gets printed. So
then you return that to the district.
We do return that to the district.
But not within a short time.
Correct. It is certainly not a 30-day turnaround.
And number 3, suggesting ways families can help students to meet or exceed academic standards. That's definitely going to be a local recommendation. But that seems to me one that's very important, especially for students who need to attend summer school or some kind of extended learning program. To what extent do we know if that's done today?
Ms. Newman.
Thank you. I can't speak to how frequently that is done now or how many districts are using those preliminary parent reports and sending those home today. I would say that a district has the information. Again, if I had tested today, then my school or district has as Representative Christensen pointed out, for the majority of them,
yes,
the right information to suggest ways. And I think that, may I also just say that should be coupled not just based on their MCA score. So when they're sending home ways that they can help students meet or exceed the standards, that shouldn't be taking into account just their MCA score.
Correct.
That should be,
yeah,
taking into account what they're seeing in the classroom and,
right,
and all of the information that they have as the parent, as the teacher in the district. So I think that a school and district has number 3 today if I had tested today, they have what they need to do number three. So I don't have any concerns about the ability of the district to do that. I do think this would require to get it to the parents in today's, without our fiscal impact, would be a fiscal impact on the district to print out that piece of that PDF for each individual student.
And then in regard to D, so the district disseminates the testing report to the teacher. Mm-hmm. That occurs at what point? And they have it by fall, hopefully. I'm sure they do. And so they can check the achievement and track the student's performance history.
Ms. Newton.
Thank you, Chair. The district has that information. So a teacher right now, if I had tested today, my teacher has the ability to get my scores today. That does require the district to have assigned me to that student to my teacher. So there is district effort there in rostering and connecting them. We provide to the district because we don't know which teachers have which students.
Correct.
So we do provide to the district by the end of June the student's achievement level, and in the same file that we're providing at the end of June, they have the prior year information. It's not all. So if I was in eighth grade this year, it would have my eighth grade and my seventh grade scores in it, but it wouldn't go all the way back to third grade.
Right.
In the file that the district has in June. So depending on how much I had moved around, they may or may not have my information. A district always has the ability to go into our system and look up a student's assessment history, however. So they can do exports and get my individual historical information, but it's not all in a single file like it is in that individual student report for the parents to receive.
Yeah, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. It's just very complicated.
Yes,
and our end goal is to help our students learn. I've experienced this situation with my own kids where you didn't get the data until practically August or September, and then you're enrolling in classes for the next year. And so you're trying to meet, you know, gaps. And the counselors in the school are intensely focused on registration. So there isn't an opportunity to get with a counselor to say, what do I do now? Now it's been since May, and my child isn't meeting standards in reading. Where do I put them? It is taken until November or December. So I just am struggling today with my question back to you, and you don't have to answer today, but I would guess, what would be the recommendation from the department to fix this problem? If the two goals we're trying to meet, the chair's goal, which I support, is giving them utmost learning time in the classroom and then reporting on that learning to the parents in a fashion where they can act and support their child. There's got to be a better way somewhere.
There does.
Ms. Dugan or Ms. Dugan, would you like to comment on that?
We will continue to work on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, but team, we've been having these conversations at the legislature and internally about how to get districts the cleanest data, you know, that they can use with their parents, and we're keenly aware of the situation. We can keep going back and talking internally and talking with the commissioner about ways to enhance that summertime with the performance from the prior year. I'm not sure if we're necessarily going to have implementable recommendations or ideas, but we can certainly keep the conversation alive about how to do that, and we always entertain opportunities to have discussions with legislators in committee and offline.
Representative Marinari.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so several questions. One is that, first, before I ask the question, this, and I think this is actually a pretty good idea. However, it raises the question of the place and the value of formative assessments in the educational process. And so it strikes me as we're having this conversation a couple things. You know, one, kind of the bigger macro question about whether the MCAs provide the formative information that is helpful for instructors and parents. And I think we can have an honest, you know, discussion about to what degree that's possible. But I take it that school districts are still conducting formative assessments in addition to the MCAs. And so it seems to me, in Representative Haley's question, that there are other opportunities in which a parent can receive that kind of information, perhaps in a more timely way. What I don't know is how uniform, you know, that is across the state. I suspect that it's not, that's probably kind of a district by district scenario. So I'm just looking, I guess, from you, Ms. Dugan, and you know, what is the state of formative assessment happening across the state that could answer some of the concerns that Representative Haley put out?
Ms. Dugan.
So there was a group that met for the majority of 2017 that really was looking at what is the design of a future assessment system in Minnesota. And I won't give all of the interim pieces. Their report is posted, and at the end of the time, and they really grappled with a lot of topics, and a lot of it did focus around that formative piece and how do we make the MCAs more meaningful, more immediate, more embedded in the curriculum instead of pulling out losing instructional time, but really truly embedded in the instruction. And where that work group landed at the end of their time, as is reflected in their report, is that their recommendation was to actually, in essence, acknowledge what the MCAs are and probably more importantly acknowledge what they are not and what they are not designed to do, and they are not designed to be formative or necessarily impact the instruction for an individual student. For an individual student, they're designed to be part of a much more comprehensive picture. They're really designed to be that, unfortunately, they're designed to be that system check for the school and then ultimately for the district. And so they serve that purpose. They serve that purpose well. They don't serve the purpose of informing an individual student's way that they what does this individual student need to do in order to meet or exceed standards. That's not what the test is designed to do, and it doesn't do that well at all. The MCA score does provide information about where a student's performance is, and certainly, again, as part of that past performance history, a picture of, well, was this just did they just have a bad day because every other year they were, knocking it out of the park, and clearly this was just an anomaly, or is this a pattern of that we're seeing things go down? So what it's designed to do of being a system check and to give a broad picture of a student's mastery of the state standards, it does that well. It does not address number three on page 7 of what skills am I lacking, what am I lacking as an individual student. It's not designed to do that, and it does not do that well. And so that work group really, where they landed was, we need to be more transparent with what we are doing, and definitely more transparent about what we're not doing, and then ultimately they also landed in recommending that we
keep the MCAs as much as, in a very broad sense, keep the MCAs as the MCAs and not try to move it into the curriculum, because once you start making something standardized and part of accountability and all of those other pieces that we all acknowledge the MCA scores get used for, then it puts constraints on that individual parent, teacher, in a way that group did not want to move forward with. So that's the closest that I can come to saying where, what the test does and what it doesn't do.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Ms. Dugan, and quite frankly, I think Representative Erickson was quite transparent, of course, in the beginning about, you know, talking about particularly for the coming year, in terms of, you know, that instructor knowing where their student ended up, if you will, at the end of that prior academic year. And I think there is value in that for sure. What about the question of the universality of formative assessments in the state? What does it look like out there?
Ms. Dugan.
So thank you for that. It's been a while since we did a survey of districts asking them what they did administer for formative assessments. At that point in time, the vast majority of the districts were administering NWEA. Mm-hmm. I do believe there is, and again, districts could speak to this infinitely better than I can, but I believe that there is a shift in those formative assessments and moving more towards FAST assessments, mm-hmm, rather than NWEA, because they are shorter. And that means that they take up less of the instructional time. And so we don't really have a good feel for what is being administered out there, admittedly, for formative assessments. We haven't surveyed them recently.
Well, and Mr. Chair and members, I suspect that it's not universal.
No, it's not.
Where it's at, and so, you know, there's an issue there, right? So, but I want to come back to 7.3 because you just referenced that. You mentioned it earlier. I think, you know, Representative Aaron said that it, her head on this, but I just want to be really clear about, you know, when it comes to legislative intent here, that when we talk about suggesting ways for families to help students meet academic standards, we're not, and I'm just checking with the author here, we're not saying that the form of a question. Are we saying that that the way to determine that is solely through the MCA results? What I heard Ms. Dugan say is it's going to take more than that, and I think you nodded. But I want to be real clear that is what we're saying if we pass this legislation, that this doesn't just solely rest on MCA results, this issue of suggesting ways to help students meet academic standards. So I'm just looking for your legislative intent,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, of course not.
Yeah.
But we are standards based, and the MCAs are there for a reason. But, Mr. Chair, I'd like to lay the bill over, because this has gotten very complicated and very time-consuming, and I think we're not going to solve anything sitting here tonight. So I just want to lay it over, and maybe I'll come up with something more unique for us to study.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mariano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, and of course, that's your prerogative. I think you have a pretty good bill, and I think it's just a matter of, you know, how are we really clear about what legislative intent is and understanding of limitations around our MCA summative assessments, even as we accept them as important for telling us about systems, performance relative to our standards.
And Mr. Chair, I agree with Representative Mariani, but I think in this short session, perhaps this is a little bit too much to bite off. We need more thoughtful discussion about it. And certainly having Ms. Dugan here, you know, sheds a tremendous amount of light on how complex testing is, mm-hmm, And, you know, it's really sad that we take away all those learning days from our children. But, you know, we're standards-based, and we have state accountability and federal accountability. Here we are, and as I keep saying, I have to honor the law. And so I think, you know, I'm just going to lay it over.
The chair renews Representative Erickson's motion to House File 2859 as amended. You laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And Mr. Chair, I have to correct that motion. I'm just laying the bill over.
I'm just laying. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Renews the motion just to lay it over.
Yes, thank you. So let's go on to the last one of the night, because I promised my colleagues they'd be out of here by 6:30, and it's not going to happen. Sorry about that. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 1420 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and to bring up the delete all, the DE1. So I'd like to move the DE1.
Okay. Representative Erickson would like to move her to your amendment. So Representative Erickson moves the H1420 DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is really where I want to put my emphasis tonight, and this is a way that I figured out to take the ESSA plan, which is our federal accountability, and put it into the world's best workforce, which is our state accountability plan. Because a lot of you know that last year I was urging the commissioner, as she and her team, and they did yeoman's work, believe me. I'm very impressed with the work of the commissioner and the team, and you've heard me here say this before, because they were very ambitious in our ESSA plan. And I want to salute them for that even tonight as we work on this new proposal. But it's confusing and it's conflicting to have two accountability systems. So what this proposal does, members, if you follow with me, is that it takes a definition of the state plan, of course, on page one, and then also sets down definitions that are in the ESSA plan so that we know what an ineffective teacher, inexperienced teacher, an out-of-field teacher means as the ESSA plan is honored for the state of Minnesota. And then in section two, what I do is I take the world's best workforce and embed in those five goals to strive for that were determined by Representative Marquardt and Representative Mariani, I believe, in the 13-14 session. Yes, I put the MCAs into that, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. So that's what I've added to these five components of the world's best workforce. So as you notice in the text, number one, the size of the academic achievement gap. That's a performance measure for the world's best workforce, and that'll be measured by the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And then what we already do is rigorous course taking and enrichment. Then we have the student performance in reading and math, high school graduation rate. What I'm doing now is citing the essay, putting it into the world's best workforce. The high school graduation rate, the career and college readiness. And members, I want to remind you that on MMB's website, they do show our world's best workforce in the form of, I think maybe you have it in front of you. Do they have this? Yes, you have this chart. This is on the MMB website, and this is the world's best workforce. And so you can go to this website and see how important the world's best workforce has become. And so now if we take the ESSA plan and embed that in that and have one accountability system and one goal with the ESSA as the benchmarks, I think we're accomplishing more. And then I was going to finish with number five, performance measures consistent with the state plan, such as our consistent attendance. As you know, that's the fifth indicator that we have in the ESSA plan. So I'm looking at the ESSA plan then as being the benchmark for the world's best workforce plans. Then finally, in section four, I'm changing the verb shall to must
so that school districts know that they must have this annual meeting to review with the public and their stakeholders their world's best workforce plan, and then that the commissioner reports annually to the commissioner must annually include in the school performance reports that which is required under 120B.36 sub 1, and then student performance at each school district and school site. And I think that's part of the report card or performance that the commissioner is presently working on. And then the annual evaluation, using the performance measures to identify over three consecutive years. And then I've added in C that the 2% now that you heard Mr. Uni refer to, up to 2%, which is in the original World's Best Workforce plan that was created by, as I said, Representative Marquardt and Representative Mariani, evidence-based strategies and best practices to make this more clear in what it is that districts must do when they have need to improve because they show 3 years of not reaching their performance goals, which now will be the MCAs. And then the commissioner will report to us, to the legislature, and in the at the same time as the commissioner delivers the list of school districts that didn't submit their reports, that the commissioner will also identify those that are not making sufficient progress toward the world's best workforce goals under this new sub 1, paragraph C. So, members, with that said, I'll certainly stand for questions. This is to be a work in tandem so that we have ESSA embedded in the world's best workforce to avoid confusion and conflicting expectations. And I did briefly mention this today when I met with schools and superintendents and others, but we'll have to see how you think it'll work. So, Mr. Chair, that's the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any questions for Madam Chair? Representative Martin,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Aronson, for this work. I'll try to be very quick. So on page 2, 2.17 through 2.19, we have the change in terms of career and college readiness as a goal, right, one of the major goals in the world's best workforce, the performance measures, rather. And then it prescribes that that be measured by student performance and MCAs in reading and math. So a couple of quick questions. One is, do we know whether those assessments themselves are psychometrically aligned to career and college readiness? And very specifically, in our definition elsewhere, college career readiness, we talk about no remediation needed. My understanding is that we have students who, in fact, measure well on the MCAs, but nonetheless are in remediation work. And I don't know what that means, you know, whether it means there's something faulty with our tests or something faulty with the placement that's happening, you know, in post-secondary. So that's question one, is whether or not, what is the reassurance that we have that, in fact, measuring college and career readiness based on MCA reading and math is, in fact, a strong indicator of college and career readiness. And then the other question very quickly is related to that. Are there other measures that we shouldn't be considering to determine career and college readiness in addition to the focus on the reading and math MCAs?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, yes, I think that the MCAs have proven that they can show career and college readiness. Just the fact that MMB is posting this on their website, I think, shows that they're honoring this part of our world's best workforce goals. And along with that, you know, the fact that they are using math and reading as the standard to get there. So I think that's true. And I think that we have some in the audience who might want to testify to that very issue in regard to career and college readiness. So is there anyone in the audience who wanted to? Mr. Bartholomew, did you want to comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. State your name again for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and kind of catching me just off the top, but a couple thoughts, Representative Mariani. The first one is at the time, Minskew, I think it was Chancellor Rosenstone, had submitted a letter with, I think it was our waiver request or race to the top application, stating that the state standards were aligned to Minnesota State's admissions expectations. So it, in that regard, that could be a proxy that our K-12 standards did lead to readiness for at least admissions into the Minnesota State institutions. And I think in his letter, he indicated that if they mastered the standards, they'd be ready without remediation. Another response off the top is the Getting Prepared report that shows students who score proficient on the MCA's reading and math compared to students who do not. And based, I think it's the 2016 report's the one I last remember, but for example, students on the 11th grade math MCAs, students scoring proficient or above were 90% likely to go on to post-secondary, which was much higher than students who were not. And I think the remediation for students who were proficient or above was 7%. And again, it was a higher percent for students who were not proficient or above. So it was a fairly strong indicator that kids not only were prepared for post-secondary, but actually went as well. But that was the Getting Prepared report that's off out of the Office of Higher Ed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bartholomew and Madam Chair, my understanding is a little bit different. As I look at the definition of career college readiness in statute, it clearly says that we're moving students forward where there's no need for remediation, and we do know from data that there are students who are passing, quote-unquote, our MCAs, moving into our systems and are being placed in remediation. Now, I don't know what that means, you know, but I think it's really important that we get this right. If we bake this into this, then the expectation of our public is going to be that our world's best workforce is guaranteeing, based on the on this criteria here, that their students should not be in remediation courses. So I think, you know, we ought to move very carefully, make sure we double check, you know, this. And quite frankly, I think what we ought to be doing, I'm not necessarily adverse to the MCA reference, but I think we ought to also consider multiple measures as a way to be able to signal to the public that we know and understand there are several things that are important for career and college readiness. So a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, my apologies. I forgot there was one other reference point that might be helpful. It was to implement a law that you passed a couple years ago that said if students score at a particular level on the MCAs, they would be exempt from remedial coursework at Minnesota State institutions.
Yes.
And MDE and Minnesota State worked contracted with HUMRO, I believe, was the evaluator, and they did actually find that Minnesota State did identify a score on the MCAs that indicated kids were not going to need remediation. In my memory, I've got the report, but the bottom line is it was, if not at the proficiency score, it was very close. So that was an independent study done for Minnesota State to identify an MCA score that indicated they were prepared without need for remediation.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Representative Bartholomew, I do remember that, and I remember having a conversation with the Chancellor afterwards, and there was a little bit of cold feet on his part after we did that. So we could obviously legislate, you know, what an outcome could be. The real issue for me is whether or not that's a real-life outcome because we don't want to do students a disservice. I'm not suggesting that Representative Erickson is attempting to do that, on the contrary. But, you know, just because we say something in statute doesn't mean in reality that, that it isn't there. And if there's a need for, you know, remediation work on the part of students who, in fact, are passing our MCAs, then there's a need for it. And all I'm suggesting here is that give ourselves some room here, you know, as we're referencing the MCAs, to consider multiple measures for career and college readiness determination.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, you know, career and college ready may show up as a continuation of the fifth indicator for the ESSA plan, but now it's consistent attendance. But I know the commissioner has considered adding, and if that's going to be added to the ESSA state goals, then I think that I would consider the MCAs in math and language arts reading to be of the caliber that would almost assure us that they're career and college ready if they are achieving at a proficient level or at least a near proficient as they head for college or for career.
Is there any other testifiers have concerns to Bill?
Surprise, surprise. Again, my name is Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ado Shuni, Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. On this bill, I was able to reach out to Representative Erickson. You know, the intent of the bill for alignment is a good one, and that's a discussion I think we've been having since the start of the passage of the ESSA in 2015. How are we going to align with our world's best workforce system? And boy, me walking through not being an expert on this was just a lot to comprehend around talking with our accountability team and the commissioner around areas where we could do tweaks and fixes and changes to really get an alignment here. And again, through the lens of that the intent is good, we want to make sure that we get the alignment right so that carrying on from the conversation we had on Tuesday around the summative system, where we want to make sure that we don't have confusion between our ESSA accountability system and a system that may be slightly different or very different in certain capacities with different focuses on different tools. So we want to make sure that we're aligned there. And one example, I think that the discussion we just had on the career and college readiness indicators, here we've got the high school MCA assessments in reading and math. One of the conversation points with our ESSA stakeholder groups is they'd like to see varied menu of options for looking at career and college readiness as we go out into the future, and that would include things like PSEO participation, concurrent enrollment. I know you had some language here originally around CTE certificates, but they were talking about CTE course taking even being a part of that, AP and IB courses. So we're really looking at kind of a rich, diverse set of indicators to look at these performance measures of how our districts are meeting their goals. I don't want to delve into all of the points on this bill, just for the sake of time, as well as saying, you know, to the author, I think the commissioner is very, very interested in making this alignment work functional, and we'd be happy to have our team, especially Stephanie Graff and Greg Keith, work with the author on points to make sure that this aligns kind of with what the work has been under our ESSA work and what the work is that we've been doing under World's Best Workforce, and to share with the author kind of the thoughts around the best practices in the different areas. But I think this is a, you know, this is a good start where we can work towards a good product that really represents the work that's been done with our ESSA work but maintains the integrity of World's Best Workforce and the work that the districts are doing under that model.
Thank you, Mr. Are there any questions for Mr. Rooney?
I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, that, you know, when you think of the ESSA state goals, they're broad, they're very good, they're ambitious, and I'll just, you know, read a couple of them. In ESSA, we have reading and math achievement rate of 90 with no student group below 85 by 2025. And that would be third grading rate, again, of 90 with no student below 85, eighth grade reading math of 90. You know, so I consider these benchmarks
And with the world's best workforce being our state accountability system, I felt we needed to turn to something that we have access to, and our students perform on the MCAs. And so let's make those the performance measures of the world's best workforce and make these the benchmarks, because, you know, these are our great goals. But I think if we're going to think about the world's best workforce as our state accountability system, that if we are going back and forth between these ESSA state goals and our world's best workforce, I think our districts are really going to be conflicted. So I certainly want to continue to work on this. I would like to include it in the omnibus bill and work on it in the next couple weeks, because I think there are things that we could straighten out a little bit. But I like the fact that we could look at the world's best workforce in a more concrete way than we have been, using the MCAs since they are there, and then continue, as I said, to use the ESSA plan as the benchmark.
President Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just not even that part of that discussion, but are there two amendments to this bill?
No, the other one is not being offered.
Okay, thank you.
That was Representative Erdahl's.
Thank you.
He couldn't offer it. He was just messing up my bill. I could say that because he's not here, no.
I would have had the commissioner's blood boiling.
God bless Representative Erdahl. But. I suppose I should have announced that I wasn't going to offer that one.
Got it.
Thank you for noticing it, Representative Pryor.
Because he's not here to tell us.
Well, and he's having a little discussion with me later, so.
Madam Chair, you can always use the minority's lead to pass information that you may not want to pass.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify either for or against? Welcome to the stand. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I just wanted to come, and I'm not sure if we're totally in support or if we're in the middle or where we are, but we have had many conversations.
You're probably in the middle.
Thank you. We have had many conversations with Representative Erickson about how do we, that current, since ESSA state plan was approved and the world's best workforce was in 2015, we now currently have two accountability systems in the state. And that would cause lots of confusion for parents, for our communities, for our students. And so we have been trying to, we have had many conversations, like I said, about how do we merge these two. And the interesting thing about it is that when you look at the two, there are a lot of similarities in the two plans and some differences. And so we have two principles, though, that we would, as school board members, what we would want to abide by in no matter how this plays out. And the first one is that the goals or how you, the strategic plan on how to reach those benchmarks are locally determined. What kind of increments would you make in strategically towards the ESSA, World's Best Workforce Goals, that would be a local decision. And then the other is that there would be no new mandates, no new reporting requirements. So to that point, I will say that there is one, actually one less report in this report, and that is in Section 4, Subdivision 5, and so we do appreciate that. And when we did have conversations with Representative Erickson, we talked about that this might be an opportunity to reduce some of the reporting. And so we do appreciate that. We do look forward to the conversations that she has with the department and see, just to make sure that the integrity of either system is not compromised. But we trust that those conversations will happen and that we will be able to come to some consensus. So with that, I conclude my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich.
And then, Mr. Chair, there's the Senate.
Yeah.
We're only half. We're about a fourth way there.
Any other testifiers in the audience would like to testify either for or against? Any questions from our representatives? All right. With that, the chair renews Representative Erickson's. Chair. Closing comments.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I think it's late enough. I've talked long enough and confused everybody more than I wanted to, and so I think we just lay 1420 as amended over with possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Newser, Representative Erickson's motion that House File 1420 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. I see no other things on the agenda, so I...
Well, members, next week on Tuesday will be the walkthrough of the omnibus bill. We hope to have it posted Sunday, Ms. Farah, Sunday night.
Madam Chair, we hope so.
And then on Thursday, you'll have your amendments, and we'll do the markup and to send the bill to finance.
That's it.
Isn't that exciting?
Yes.
So that's it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, having completed the agenda before us, the meeting is adjourned.